implementation of international agreements, and as well as looking at legislation for review. Thereafter, we will look at the CAF CETA, and then for our own in-house, we ask members to look at the current terms program that we want to place before yourself. I trust by that time we would have a quorum to look at that, which we don't have at the moment. I am nevertheless saying that we should still proceed with the meeting. If any decision needs to be taken, then of course such a decision would require a quorum. Let me welcome you. The apologies that we have before us is Honorable Kasim. He's apparently on paternity leave, I believe. It's a baby something. A little baby. No, honourable members, I'm not going to get into the fact that Honourable Kasim might be having his ninth child. No, please. It's a baby, let's just say. He's on paternity leave, and we wish him well. As well as the baby, we wish well also. The other apologies that we have is from Honourable Bata, Kubisa, and Simon. Honourable members, may I remind you that, as you know, the rules of Parliament have changed. Those of you that are now absent for 3 meetings, you need to send permission from your party that you are allowed for the 3rd meeting to be absent. The rule says that it's the end of you if you haven't come here for 3 meetings. So some of those ones are 3 now already. And I would suggest that you apply the rules in relation to what it says. It's not just an ordinary one. It's one that comes with permission from the party of why they are absent for 3 meetings, so that the National Assembly will accordingly decide. As you know, our monies are being deducted from now onwards. When we are absent, so I'm just asking that we apply the rule. I did say this when the rules change, I did say to the members. The other aspect that I just want to announce before we start, honourable members, some of you might know, Parliament has slowly but surely updating its IT. And Parliament now has an application that includes, amongst other things, also committee staff. You are going to start getting your committee staff on Parliament's application. We will invite them here one morning, and they will then sit with each one of you if you haven't gone to them, and they will upload the Portfolio Committee on Higher Education from where the documentation and so on will be sent. There are a number of other things that is also very useful on there. With your permission, honourable members, if you don't mind, we can just ask them to come along, not today, just at a suitable morning, to come along and do the necessary stuff. I want to stop there. I know many of you are tempted to talk about the fall of pirates last night, but now this is a meeting of higher education and training, and I'm not a pirate supporter, so I wouldn't want us to talk about that one. May I focus on the international agreements? I can see all the sad faces, but international agreements. Let's not talk about Mushin Etagra. Over to the department. You will also introduce your delegation. Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable Chairperson, and honorable members of the Portfolio Committee. The Director General of the Department of Higher Education and Training has allocated a strong team of the officials of the department from the branch planning policy and support to do the two presentations as requested by the Portfolio Committee. And I'm pleased to introduce to you two senior officials who are going to handle these two presentations. On my left is the Chief Director for International Relations, Mr. Khalib Chepi. And after his presentation, Advocate Eben Bosoff, who is also a Chief Director for Legislative Services within our department, will do the two presentations as requested. May I also indicate that our delegation includes the CFO of the Department of Education, Mr. Trudeau, and also later on, I think Mr. Lumka will be introduced, who will be dealing with the issues that relates to the CETAS as it appears in the program. On the subject of the progress report on the implementation of international agreements, may I just cite the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa that provides for international law in Chapter 14, whereas it states that the negotiating and the signing of all the international agreements is the responsibility of the national executive, and that an international agreement binds the Republic only after it has been approved by a resolution in both the National Assembly and the National Council of Provinces. On that note, then, the Department of Education has a dedicated chief directorate that deals with all those issues that emanate from the Constitution in support of the mandate of the Minister of Education on this area. Mr. Chepi.
Thank you very much, Dr. Titi, and good morning. Good morning, and thank you very much, Honourable Chair and honourable members of the Portfolio Committee, ladies and gentlemen, and colleagues. The story that I'm about to unpack reflects directly to the partnerships that our Department of Higher Education and Training have entered into over a longer period, and I'll look at the shorter but also slightly at the longer period of our engagements with the international community. As my colleague has indicated, the agreements that we've entered into are governed by the Constitution and directly also under the Vienna Convention, which makes it binding on countries when they enter into international partnerships. These agreements are scrutinized by the Department of Justice, by the international law advisors at the Department of DERCO, and ultimately approved by the President. The Department of Higher Education and Training strategies, plans, and priorities for the post-school system provide the platform upon which the international engagements are based and premised on. The International Relations Chief Directorate takes its mandate from the white paper on the post-school higher education and training system and speaks to the importance of the internationalization project in higher education and training. The Chief Directorate has been set up to pursue the educational diplomacy function abroad within the context, and I need to stress this, within the context of our foreign policy. We do not operate alongside or outside of the parameters of our foreign policy. Our Chief Directorate then supports the Performance Agreement 5, Outcome 5 and Output 5, which speaks to an increase in research, development, innovation in human capital for a growing knowledge economy. But the drivers for our engagement are really fivefold. It's the exchange of best practices and benchmarking in a global context, to pursue international opportunities for human resource and skills development, to mobilize external resources to support the departmental agenda, to support and contribute to outreach programs, and this is done through trilateral or bilateral cooperation, Fifth one is to develop South Africa as a regional and continental knowledge hub. And lastly, again, to emphasize that the support of the Department of International Cooperation through our educational diplomacy is then vital. And I'll come back to some of these drivers in a moment. Our program then is anchored in the department's policies, which ultimately aim to meet our developmental goals of a developing and capable and well-educated and skilled citizenry, to participate in international exchange and production of knowledge and skills. More importantly, the department's international cooperation again is framed within the parameters of our foreign policy. So some of the considerations then for our agreements and declarations or conventions or memorandum of understanding, as it may be termed. We cooperate through bilateral and multilateral agreements in order to forge strong educational alliances and programs. The department encourages direct linkages and partnerships between our universities and colleges as well. But not all countries allow for direct institutional agreements unless and before there is an overarching agreement in place between two governments. So in order for a university to cooperate with another university in South Africa, there needs to be an overarching agreement. We prioritize, in terms of our foreign policy, obviously Africa and South-South initiatives, not excluding an important engagement with the North. But all of these agreements and engagements are evaluated on the basis of the priorities for us as a sector, the competencies that they are seeking to engage in, reciprocity and feasibility to a large extent. But not all our engagements are also governed by agreements. There are also just direct bilateral arrangements between systems, between departments that are happening. And so then for the Chief Director for International Relations, it is responsible for ensuring that we do meet our international obligations to the agreements and conventions that we are party to. But that we also deliver these agreements, not in isolation, but in partnership with our post-school sector institutions. If we were to look just at the agreements at a glance, and I've just done this kind of alphabetically, not chronologically in terms of date and so forth, we've entered into an agreement in 2015 with Angola, and the Angolese are looking specifically at partnering with us in terms of institutional linkages, exchange of research, the development of joint projects, and we are now about to sign the implementation plan. So each agreement requires an implementation plan with clear milestones, clear budgets attached to the agreement. The second country is with Burundi, signed in 2011. So this was 2 years after the creation and the establishment of our department. And we identified teacher training, and this was done mutually, of course, teacher training as an important area, exchange of delegations to familiarize ourselves with what opportunities exist. But because of the internal political situation in Burundi, we've not been able to execute work in that country. On BRICS, last year in Moscow, we signed a declaration which speaks to the formation of the BRICS network of universities covering 12 South African universities within the other with each of the BRICS member countries participating. We've just recently signed a declaration which speaks to the areas of collaboration that we are going to be cooperating, namely in technical, vocational education and training, the mutual recognition of qualifications within the member states and amongst the member states, hosting of academic seminar, etc. With China in 2015, during the FOCAC meeting last year, on the margins of the meeting itself, we entered into a partnership agreement with the Chinese government to provide 2,000 short-term skills training opportunities. And we have successfully managed to ensure that our various categories of participants have gone to China for short-term seminars, training, etc. In 2016, we've sent to date 223 participants in various sectors: construction, marine, manufacturing, renewable energy, nuclear energy, food safety, etc. And the PCTA is managing this program on our behalf. On Cuba, we've entered into a bilateral agreement, and it was to promote the studying of Spanish. Colleagues would recall that area studies previously was quite an important focus of institutions, but because of the decline of the humanities generally, the first areas for removal were going to be area studies. So we've tried to revitalize some of the area studies by way of seeking support, and one of which is going to be Spanish studies as a language. We've also encouraged exchanges amongst and between institutions in Cuba. And the program that we are now setting up is an area program, area studies program on Latin American studies in particular. The proposal has just recently been developed, and we are looking at getting the resources set aside for that. With the European Union in 2012, we have entered into a strategic relationship amounting to, on the one side, a developmental agenda of cooperation in supporting the transformation projects in South Africa through its official development assistance program, but also in terms of what happens beyond aid. And this agreement then speaks to the program Beyond Aid around dialogue with the European Union member countries. And so we've identified these areas as potential areas for the dialogue to kickstart the dialogue, really. So it's around mobility in higher education. Currently, to date, we have over 800 postgraduate students who have benefited from a mobility program funded by the EU. Strengthening collaboration, obviously, between the EU member states and South African universities. Equity and quality in education. Again, the question of the recognition of qualifications between South Africa and the EU member states. Initial and continuing teacher education, benchmarks in education, lifelong and technical vocational education. So these are the topics that we've identified, and we've already hosted three seminars in this regard with our counterparts in the European Union. On Germany, we've entered into a bilateral arrangement where they are supporting and collaborating with us on providing advice as we set up the South African Institute for Vocational and Continuing Education and Training. They're also providing us support with the experiences of piloting the dual system project, whereby South African students within the project are placed at placed in German companies. And we've had a few study visits been sponsored by the German government to date. With Palestine, we've entered into an agreement in 2014. And yeah, essentially, it's also looking at the familiarization of understanding their system, our system, the exchange of best practices and experiences, also around the comparability of qualifications that becomes important. Another important area that we are exploring is around the question of the establishment of a Middle Eastern and African studies program between the two countries. Now, all our knowledge on the Middle East is essentially secondary. And what we are saying is that we need to develop primary knowledge. We need to develop our own expertise in the area of the Middle East to understand the socio-economic and political context under which countries of the Middle East are operating, and that would inform our institutions as well. At the moment, we are in discussions around the recognition of qualifications with Palestine. With the Russians in 2013, we signed the mutual recognition of equivalence and educational qualifications and academic degrees agreement. We've established a committee of experts because there's been a healthy flow of people between Russia and South Africa, and the qualifications required to be recognized, and this was the first example of a mutual qualifications agreement that we entered into, and there are several others that we are looking at now, as I'll indicate later. The oldest and the longest agreement, and that's now obviously embedded within the department, is the SADC Protocol on Education and Training, signed in 1997, which we've taken on as a department, and it speaks to the provisioning of and reservation of space for our students in each other's countries. We're also serving on a number of technical committees, namely in vocational education, higher education being the last one that we've just set up a year and a half ago, and on open and distance learning. Our challenge is obviously to ensure that we also get opportunities for South African students to be placed at institutions in the region. On Saudi Arabia, we have a mutual agreement again in terms of cooperation and placement of students. We are in discussions now with them on the recognition of qualifications agreement. Syria, we entered into an agreement in 2009, and it was essentially also looking at an exchange of academics, experts, and students. We've had probably 4 or 5 students that have gone to Syria in the beginning. We've made the case to use Syria as the hub for the Middle Eastern Studies program, but because of the ongoing situation in Syria, we've not been able to implement it at this stage. Agreements that are being negotiated down the line are including Cameroon, Vietnam, Namibia, Brazil, India, Mozambique, and Russia. Hungary and Poland and Romania are about providing South Africa essentially scholarships, and we're looking at different numbers and levels of scholarship provision that we're going to be getting from these countries, amounting sometimes to 100 per country. With China, Cuba, and Malaysia, it is looking at a mutual qualifications agreement in particular. So those are the 3 countries that we would be looking at qualifications agreements as we go forward. So flowing then, Chair and colleagues, from these agreements is that our students are getting exposure and academic opportunities through the scholarships that come through these bilateral agreements. So in the case here, we have received opportunities from Ireland, China, Russia, Sweden, Japan, Chile, and the EU. We're also aware of a number of South African students that are privately funded and that are pursuing their studies in these countries and others, but who are studying there privately. I don't have figures, for example, the United Kingdom, because that scholarship arrangement is dealt with by the embassy independently under the Chevening Scholars Program. So we don't collaborate on that at all. We do, however, assist by advertising and disseminating information on scholarships. So as the next slide indicates, we advertise on our website opportunities that are given by the Australians, South Korea, Algeria, the African Union, Mexico, United Kingdom, New Zealand, US, and so on. But that's done principally by those embassies in Pretoria. We are in discussions with them to see how we can actually identify, also to ensure that we have the representation issues of gender and race as part of the determining factors when sending students abroad. Some of these, obviously, private foundations that are administered by the embassies themselves. Moving on to the third aspect of our bilateral agreements, which is covered under the Official Development Assistance Program, we have to date then also entered into partnerships with Denmark around skills development, and in particular getting Danish support and assistance with student support services for 12 TVET colleges. On the with the European Union, we've been in partnership with them around the development and coordinating mechanisms for career services, career development and the national qualifications framework. We are now in the phase of looking at the open learning systems and increasing access to post-school opportunities under that project. The third project that we are getting resources for is for teaching, what we've referred to as teaching and learning development sector. And this is really for supporting teacher development, initial teacher development, as our competency as a department, in ECD, in special needs, in primary, TVET, and open learning. With the Japanese, we are getting support by placing a very modest number, six volunteers in Japan at the Technical Vocational College in Mpumalanga, but also getting support for a university project that's located at TUT and now has expanded to all technical universities on cognitive skills development in the workplace. I need to also just mention, it's not on the slide there, around the support that we have been receiving from major philanthropies, and they are really giving the support directly to our universities, and we encourage this kind of support because it also supports our research capacity at universities from philanthropies such as Mellon and Carnegie, etc., and they do consult the department from time to time on the priority programs. The Netherlands project is just about to come to a completion, and it's looking at student support services, lecturer development, and student work placement. On the United States, used to be a major donor to the sector. I think because of South Africa being classified a middle-income country, they've largely decreased the overall support package and envelope to the country. So we have three remaining initiatives, but it's also done directly with the universities, and we want to certainly encourage that. The one is on support to the Faculty of Law around rebuilding constitutionalism, and this is with a number of countries in sub-Saharan Africa that come to the University of Pretoria. On research development in solar energy again, the universities of Stellenbosch, Fort Hare, Namibia, and Botswana are engaged in this project. And then there's an agricultural project that's also online. The support that the Germans are giving in terms of development cooperation, because I spoke earlier about the German bilateral agreement, has been on support for advice on the setting up of our institute, etc. This is speaking more directly to the official development assistance which they're granting to curriculum development for renewable energy technologies. And they're also then supporting a second project, which has just started during the course of last year, on curricular development for the occupational areas of electricians and plumbing. Having said all of this, I just need to indicate to the chair and to the honourable members, it's a very modest operation that we are running, and I think a very efficient operation, but it's staffed literally by eight people, and we're trying to cover a globe with a modest budget of 1.2 million. To conclude, Chair, I just wish to reiterate the benefits afforded to us as a department is that there's been a steady flow of cooperation with the priority countries, translating into increased scholarship opportunities, increased research opportunities for our institutions. There are a number of linkages and partnerships, and we can quantify that. The curriculum development projects that are taking place between our department and our counterparts in ministries abroad. Funding of niche project areas, which I've just indicated now, and the internships that we are able to secure in the foreign-based companies in South Africa via their chambers of commerce has been phenomenal. But it's also lent opportunities for us to benchmark against the best. and to see where we are in terms of OECD countries' research, etc., but also reporting on our commitments and ensuring solidarity with countries that are in need. We've had a number of trilateral programs in the past. But it's afforded us essentially ministry to ministry or system to system collaboration and partnerships for our universities and colleges, and the sector education and training authorities ultimately being the direct beneficiaries of our partnerships. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Without any hesitation, I'm going to ask the members to engage with your report. Honourable members, Killian, Ruela, Bazole, in that order.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thanks for the presentation. I just wanted to ask about two or three questions. The first one, Chairperson, I would like to ask, we sometimes in the news read about provincial engagements and agreements. Now, does the department fulfill any sort of coordination role as far as that is concerned? We all know higher education is an exclusive national competence, but sometimes particularly some premiers get very excited about prospects for youth and scholarships, etc. What is the department's role as far as that is concerned, and could they just give us background in relation to whether they keep track of those as well? Then secondly, Chair, the issue of the 12 universities on slide 9 that are participating in the BRICS network of universities. Could we perhaps just have an indication of which those universities are? That would be very interesting. Then also, as far as, in respect of many of the agreements, there's some other agreement of recognition of qualifications, etc. Now, we know SACWA was before us last week. How does the department coordinate that function through SACWA to make sure that we have sort of some parity and the right criteria are met when we recognize some agreements, some qualifications from these countries that we have these international agreements with. Yes, I think that concludes, Chairperson. I've made some notes, but those were some clarity-seeking questions that I have. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. And let me also welcome the presentation. But then we all know that the higher education institutions are in crisis right now with the campaigns that are going on. What I would like to know from there is, how has the current unrest in higher education impact on the SA international relations, if any? And secondly, in slide 8, you talk of scholarships that were offered and that were not taken. Perhaps you could share with us what are the possible reasons for that, but again, whether those scholarships have been reprioritized to benefit South African students, or is it still on offer for the Burundian students? And slide 23, I can see that the projects that are listed, they all have got a start and an end date, with the exception of the volunteer program to Mpumalanga, which appears to have kick-started on 2009. Is it still ongoing, or was it a one-year thing? Thank you.
Yeah,
Thank you very much for an interesting presentation. Looking at the DST, however, it looks as though they also have an international program of some substance. And given your very small budget and your very small size, and also the massive overlap between what you do and what the DST does in this area of international agreements, because they too will look at partnerships with universities, exchanges, training abroad, students coming here, all the same things. Is there not a case for the two units to work together and save duplication and spread their meager resources further? And then the second question is, you didn't mention the Chinese, the Cuban doctor program. I presume that then doesn't come under DOHET. If you could just comment on that. And then the last one is, what exactly are your strategic goals? Because international programs often end up being a lot of agreements signed, but very little actual things achieved. People at the higher level like meeting each other, and they like traveling all around the world and signing agreements, but actually turning them into action and turning them into real benefits for both sides is much more difficult. So I'm just wondering if you could comment on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. It is giving us an idea on the international agreements that we have. Mine was also on the agreement with BRICS, where there are those 12 South African universities which are participating, whilst we have 26. I'm just interested in knowing why is it the other 14 are not participating, or it's something which is not compulsory. It's not like your SADC protocol, where all higher education institutions will make a reservation for that as per the protocol. The second one, I want to say on the China agreement, I'm very impressed, especially looking at the skills that are being trained. It's really impressive. We are thinking that we are going to move forward. The last one on the TVET for the green economy. I want to know whether has there been any movement on this one, and which are the four TVET colleges that you are planning on or that have benefited from this program. Thank you, Chair.
Like those are the questions from the members. Let me just add one or two. I'm not sure if I saw this in your presentation. Are you able to tell us how many South Africans are being sought after for providing whichever countries for the kind of needs that a particular country or countries would have? We're having agreements with everyone. Does that include the fact that, you know, we've got skills of specialization that we are also providing for whichever institutions? Does the training include the world of those that are in the CETA behind you, the world of art, in exchanging that particular skill also? On the universities, we had the UniZulu before us, and one of the reasons why the Vice Chancellor was not in the meeting was because the Vice Chancellor was traveling, I don't know to where. not about, the question is not just about the Vice Chancellor. The question is related to how do you manage international programs that derive from the universities? And apart from the provinces that the previous member asked, the universities, because we see that the universities too have elaborate international programs. When the problems at the universities started, again, the Vice Chancellor of Wits was not in the country, was out of the country. How do you manage that? Because here you have all of this, and where and how do the universities fit in this? Do you collaborate together? We're not asking that you must control them, but you can collaborate together. And how do you sort of plan together on these things? And do we have exchanges that says that some countries have adopted some of the universities also? That might be the reason why these universities are also traveling extensively. If you can answer the questions.
Thank you, Chair, and I'll also just allow my colleague to address a few of the questions. But if I could just kickstart the reply to the questions. So thank you. That was very useful. Also gives me an opportunity to just elaborate on some of the aspects that I'd skimmed over. Of course, in terms of the nature of cooperative governance. There's meant to be a greater collaboration between national departments and provinces, but because the constitution is quite clear about international agreements, only national governments can enter into, and the national executive can enter into agreements. However, provinces can enter into twinning programs with cities, and it's under this auspices where the twinning arrangements between the city of Cape Town and the city of Konya in Turkey, for example, could enter into an arrangement, or between Tshwane and Beijing. Point being that sometimes our own foreign representatives abroad are not aware that there are students from a particular province in their city, because it's done bilaterally. So I think it speaks until they are arrested or until they have financial difficulties, and then they come knocking on the embassy doors to say, can you assist? And that's how we discover that they are there. So what we have now taken on board ourselves as a department with the Department of International Relations and Cooperation is to set up a structure, an intergovernmental structure, to begin unpacking the nature and opportunities that are afforded to our students that are done either bilaterally or sometimes through specialist educational entities in countries that are offering support. So I think there is a definite role for the department, because at the end, it's South African students that are studying abroad, and they're not seen as a Western Cape student or a Gauteng student, it's a South African student, and we need to support our embassies also to deal with this issue. The question was raised by two colleagues, and if I can just combine them around the BRICS issue, the universities. The first determination is that the BRICS member states agreed amongst themselves that they want to start the project of collaboration with 12 universities in each country. Now, for a country such as China, who has just under 500 universities, it was important for us, in our interest also, to be saying, look, we want to put up the best universities in our country. So the Russians had to put up 12, India 12, and so on and so forth. And so the determination then for the 12 in South Africa, because obviously we're going to be asked, why aren't you using my alma mater was simply put out the request to institutions and say, who of you would like to become part of the first phase of this network? Which doesn't necessarily mean that you would exclude those that are not interested at this stage, because each university's international relations office is also operating at a different kind of level of engagement. So the University of Witwatersrand has a flourishing partnership arrangement globally, but so too does UCT. Less, of course, would an institution such as UNISUL or Venda. The importance is that we are in an internationalization period of exchange and collaboration, and if our universities are wanting to stick and be steadfast within the 21st century, they need to collaborate globally. And so what we've then agreed on as the first phase is to take the University of Northwest, UWC, WITS, UCT, kind of branded ones, to engage in the partnerships already. The third question, honorable member, was around the mutual qualifications, recognition of agreements, and our engagement with SACWA. We have what is termed a standing experts committee made up of the South African Qualifications Authority, the Department of Higher Education, which chairs this committee, the professional councils, such as Engineering Council, the Health Professional Council, all been part of this committee, which develops, firstly, the agreement, the instrument for recognition, and then, secondly, it has to go through all the kind of technical ramifications before it will be sent off for endorsement. So once the agreement is in place, it then allows that country to have its students submit its documentation for verification to SACWA, which then becomes an automatic and easier process than for someone to come from Outer Mongolia and we don't know anything about this system. So this is really just putting in place a mechanism for ensuring that when students come from more or countries where we have a larger number of South African engagement, it's easier for the verification processes to take place. I think the honourable members, I think you're going to be better placed to answer this question of, has our institutions been affected because of the student unrest and its image globally? I think I can only ventriloquist now on behalf of the department, and I'll try my best here, but I think indeed we have been affected by the image and the reputation that we have, because historically and until very recently, our institutions have been the pride of the continent, have been the pride in the South. The fact that we have over 70,000 foreign students studying at our institutions obviously suggests that we are a very good destination, both academically, culturally, but also still economically a good and vibrant destination for pursuing undergraduate and postgraduate qualifications in the country. So I think the fact that students, some of whom had to leave early perhaps now because of the unrest to return back to their homes, because it's costing them to remain on residences or in private digs during this period, I think it has a reputational challenge for us as a country. Related to that question was whether scholarships and the reasons for scholarships not being taken up. Initially, our biggest fear was that initially students weren't prepared to go and study abroad for a number of reasons. Some of these relate to the fact that they want to try and complete their courses within time at our institutions. We have good institutions. This has always been the case. But why would you want to go to China and you're going to have to learn the language first for a year? It's an added, almost viewed by some as an impediment. But viewed by others, it's actually going to be an advantage. Because I think it's always important if a student can speak a foreign language. And so we must encourage and we try and ensure that our students, when they go abroad, that to be doing an immersion at least of a year training in that foreign language. We don't have any people in this country that can speak Pashto, which is Afghanistani language. Yeah. So I'm just using that as an example that we want to encourage our students to learn the foreign language so that we can also be supporting our own academic endeavors and economic interests when people speak foreign languages. So all our foreign students that are in foreign countries are required to learn the language. So sometimes students then apply for these and then only discover, oops, they have to do an initial year, and they kind of say no. We try not to lose these opportunities within the academic year, largely because there are a number of students that are out of university that can actually make good use of these opportunities. So it's always held over in order to find a suitable candidate. Also, the requirements of the courses are such that you require at least 60% for mathematics if you're going to go and do a particular course abroad. And so you need to find the best student, most capable student from the provinces to actually undertake these offers up. The Japanese volunteers program is continuing, and as I said, it's a very modest, it's a small program, but this is part of the soft power that's been exercised, where students come and support rural development and community work within the context of TVET colleges. The question that Honorable Solis asked around the Cuban doctors program, that's just briefly, it's within the Department of Health, but we do have obviously a watching brief, as it were, with the Department of Health on the returning doctors, because they ultimately have to come back to South Africa to take up the training next year. The drivers, as I've indicated, are really the strategic objectives of our goals, and with these goals, we have to ensure that there are suitable implementation plans to execute the five goals. And the five goals that we try and ensure in the agreements, and you're absolutely correct, I think this is also why we have taken a deliberate decision not to go with every country with an agreement. Because for every country, you need to have resources, you need to have human and financial resources to implement. So it's, for us, it's the most strategic ones, the ones that we can actually look at in terms of tangible programs of collaboration. So the strategic goals, then, is around the best practices that we have ensured mutual learning opportunities, pursuing the international opportunities for human resource development, which includes then the scholarships, mobilizing as a strategic objective the external resources to support niche projects, to contribute to the outreach programs that we have. And here clearly, you know, it's the trilateral partnerships that we're looking at between South African Department of Higher Education. We're now in discussions with the Swedes around a support program for a third country on collaboration, and then to develop as part of that South Africa as a regional and continental hub as a strategic objective of our engagements globally. And here we're saying that within that strategy for the development of the continent, we need to be putting in place area studies as a priority. South Africa and the department set up the first and the premier institution on the African continent on Chinese studies. And we're not talking language, we're talking high-end academic research that's been fostered between South African scholars at our institutions, and that's been hosted by the University of Stellenbosch. Now, Stellenbosch can't obviously just do this on its own. It has to collaborate with other institutions as well. But the Center for Chinese Studies has been located at Stellenbosch. The Center for Middle Eastern Studies program and the Center now for Latin American Studies is a program that Pretoria University, in collaboration with Salt Lake University, because the Latin American Studies program is also going to look at a number of additional areas of interest. The promotion of IBSA, India, Brazil, South Africa opportunities for cooperation have also been captured within that strategy. The question on the green economy, the beneficiaries there have largely been the Eastern Cape colleges, and the reason for the identification of the Eastern Cape, it's because of the plant in the VW plant in Volkswagen plant in Uitenhage. Yeah, so it's the colleges around that are involved with the within the German project on the green skills. So the chair has raised an interesting question of do we also have the specialisms that can be used abroad? And a good way of gauging whether South Africans are indeed also finding themselves in international organizations, in being recruited by countries to provide input and collaboration, I think would cover a range of areas. Just one particular, two particular examples would be our contribution as a country through the specialist agencies such as SADI on open and distance learning, based in Johannesburg but working within the regional context, providing services. So instead of getting the consultant from Canada, wherein the Commonwealth of Learning is located, there is a South African expertise that is resident in South Africa that can be used and that is used in the open and distance learning field. Just as an example, the research work that is being conducted on Mali, on Timbuktu, that's been done by UCT. So there are expertise in different spheres. The work that's been done by the University of Pretoria in constitutional law, it's again begging the question of what are the fields and areas that we feel that we have a leverage in that we can actually be providing outside. But the beneficiaries are not only, Chair, the higher education institutions. We've also managed to bring world skills, and that's a direct engagement of the CETAs around benchmarking and looking at what skills development is like within the global arena for the benefit of all. And so the beneficiaries of the internationalization project then of the Department of Higher Education and Training has been for the universities, the colleges, and the CETAs. The question, how do we collaborate to the universities? I was very tempted to say this is a higher grade question about 26 universities all have, to various degrees, their international offices and partnerships. And this is the premise from which we have operated as a department, that we recognize and the institutions rightfully recognize that in order to be globally competitive, in order to be producing the kinds of graduates that we need to produce, not for this world but for the next, as it were, we need to be collaborating globally. And so we participate in what we refer to as the International Education Association of South Africa, of which all 26 universities are member. Of course, the University of South Africa is an important player within that forum, where we engage in the sharing of the progress on and the discussion of the new nuances in internationalization practices. For some, internationalization amounts to the recruitment and an increase in levy opportunities. We see it as much more than just students coming. There must be collaboration of our university staff, administration, etc., in a range of fields. It's not just about, as internationalization has been reported to be a money-making exercise. It's much more than that. It's an academic project that we need to support. So we have also been visiting the international offices to get a first-hand understanding of what their programs are like, who are they collaborating with, and suggesting and providing advice and input into their own strategies. It's obviously, from time to time, the management of institutions are required, and the minister does invite some of the institutions to accompany us on official missions abroad, but there's also bilateral relations between the institutions directly that we don't really have a say in. But I wanted to allow my colleague to just answer the question on the interaction and relationship with the DST, because we do have a very good partnership with them.
Chairperson, I think in a way this question has been responded to under the strategies, the strategic objectives of the Chief Directorate. But I do want to add just two different angles to it, and one of them is the role of international relations in our department in the implementation of the National Qualifications Framework, which I think is really fundamental and mostly underreported in the system. If you look at the work of those bodies, such as the Standing Experts Committee, you actually recognize that the currency of qualifications in our sub-frameworks of the National Qualifications Framework is being serviced through the international agreements that we are engaged upon. I think we've got to understand the question about the role of both the DST and the higher education in terms of the mandates of the two different departments, that they are not the same. The forecast of each department is different. But overall, education diplomacy is the responsibility of ministers that are responsible for both basic and higher education, and that's why the work of the steering committee on the National Qualifications Framework is the role of the Minister of Higher Education, and there are no overlaps in this regard. But it is important that somehow, you keep in mind that there is always a possibility that you stray outside of those. But the fact that the role of departments is a supportive role to DERCO, one would then feel that the concern around possible overlaps would be addressed, in that relationship between departments. As we have indicated, the issue of Cuban doctors is located within the mandate of the Department of Health, but the issues of the young people that we recruit for such programs is managed within the basic education department. And once they are registered in those higher education institutions, it becomes the focus and interest area of the Department of Higher Education and Training, indeed. I think that's how far we can go with the presentation, Chairperson. And we thank you very much for the questions, and we are ready to commence with the second presentation.
I see a hand, and it's up to you, no, to take more questions. But remember, we've got two more that needs to come. Is it something that can wait, Honourable Killian?
Chairperson, I just wanted to have confirmation from the department that in terms of the legislative mandate, these agreements all fall in subsection 231, sub 3 of the Constitution. And if so, can they give us the confirmation that all of these agreements have been tabled, if they don't need to be ratified because they are of a technical nature, have they been tabled in the National Assembly in terms of the Constitution and the council, because the constitution clearly says, and it is on the slide 3, the top bullet is subsection 3. It says it must be tabled in the assembly and the council within reasonable time. So can they just give us the confirmation that that was indeed done? Thank you.
Thank you for that, Honourable Member. I was equally going to ask that, notwithstanding the fact that you make, you know, the introductory pages that you have on your legislative mandate and so on, before you get to the introduction, I was equally going to say we would have then expected you to then say, and we then suggest what you do is, either when we call you back or you say, maybe you should send to us. Send to us this one that you are talking about, and that is, insofar as international agreements are concerned, these are the ones that you have tabled in Parliament. Now, sometimes I know the tabling of some international agreements goes to somebody else also. And I think you can indicate to us also whether it is and was in the competence of higher education, I mean this committee, or whether it was directed so that the international, committee on international relations had to deal with it, because I know they deal with all sorts. If you can send that to us, to say how you have then applied what you have put here, and then of course how many are outstanding, and if they are outstanding, when will they find their way to Parliament. I suggest the second area that you must also consider coming to talk to us about, South Africa went to the United Nations, and South Africa also agreed to the, I think it's now called the SDGs, no? So from the MDGs to the SDGs. South Africa has not been doing bad at all on the MDGs. I think we reached all the targets. But I think you must come and talk to us about the SDGs, and then you must come and talk to us also. I think it will help if you gave us a very broad presentation. I think you can start narrowing it down to us, to talk to us, how does it relate to poverty, how does it relate to unemployment, how does it relate to inequality, all these, because these are our objectives of why we are engaged. We are not engaged just simply because we like to fly around and so on. We are engaged because there are certain objectives that we would want to meet, and I think it will help if you... if you put it into those contexts for us. We must, I think you answered under CETA, but I think you probably have to talk to us a little bit more about the... We raised about the universities, but the same applies to the CETAs also. They also flying up and down and so on, and are they all within the same in the same objective. We must thank you very much for your very precise and concise report that you have presented, and we look forward to you sending us the issues that we have raised, and I think it will be good if you can start preparing on the issues that we have just resolved that you need to start focusing on for us. On that note, may I thank you very much and ask the presentation on legislation. Would you like to come and sit in front? It's a bit of a difficult venue, this. It's a bit of us and them. And
good morning, Chair and Honourable Members. Thank you for this opportunity. Chair, the issue of the review of legislation is emanating from the performance targets of the department, which came about as a result of the white paper and the demands of the white paper. What is important is that when the new department came into effect, the President assigned specific pieces of legislation to the Minister of Higher Education and Training, and the white paper gave the new direction to the mandate of this department. And this legislation had to be aligned in accordance with the new directives. These legislation or the acts that were assigned by the President, they are first of all the Continuing Education and Training Act. At that stage it was the Further Education and Training Act, the same number. This act has been already reviewed, and I'll come to it now. It also deals with the other legislation is the National Student Financial Scheme Act, the Skills Development Act, the Higher Education Act, the General and Further Education and Training Quality Assurance Act, which is an act which is only partially assigned to the Minister, and the National Qualifications Framework Act. The review of the legislation commenced with the Continuing Education and Training Act. It was the view of the department that this area or the scope of this piece of legislation affect the most crucial areas of change, and this legislation was then affected or reviewed in two stages. It was already started with an amendment act in 2012, and then also in 2013, which paved the way for the changes. Now, the changes that were required by the white paper is very significant. It required that the college sector must move from the provincial domain to a national competency, and it also provide for the renaming of the former Further Education and Training colleges to become TVET colleges, and also to ensure that the new institutional type, which is the Community Education and Training Colleges, being introduced into the legal system, and to deal with the dynamics pertaining to that. And then a very important aspect was also the South African Institute for Vocational Continuing Education and Training, the SAIVSTEC, which is a entity that is put in place to support these colleges, and in particular also the newly established community the community education and training colleges. So what is important is that during this review, there were also the Parliament took the decision also to review the AET Act, which was also assigned to the Minister, but it, because of the incorporation of that mode of education into the community education and training colleges, that act was repealed. Then there was also the South African Council of Educators Act was partially assigned to the minister insofar it affects colleges. The legislation also been repealed and been transferred to in terms of the Continuing Education and Training Act. However, there is still some reference to it in it in terms of the registration of your lecturers with the colleges. It is an area which is also a possibility that there can in future be amendments, but that will not be as a result of the white paper requirements. But Chair, at this point in time, resources and the setting up of such a structure.
Sorry, I see that we're stuck on introduction.
Chairperson, we find it very difficult to know where he is. Whoever is operating the system, I don't know if we have a systemic problem there.
Yeah, but on the copy, I also saw where they had to go further down. That's not on in the copy. So only the first. So you know when you press and the other sentences go, it's not in here.
Yeah, Chair, I apologize. It is on slide 4, but what I've just said is not in the slide. I just added it there, Chair. I apologize, and I can amend the slide and resend it to you. This part about the other repealed legislation, I did not include it because it was already dealt with in this committee, and I was just refreshing the committee's memory on it. So it is not on the slides.
Okay, but those that you are trying to refresh are not in this committee anymore.
I apologize, Chair. But I can amend the slides and resend it to you.
Please.
It was just because the intention is to deal with the current legislation that is under the control of the minister. The slides do deal with all the current legislation. I just included those that have been repealed because I referred to the legislation that was initially assigned by the president to the minister, and I was just to clarify that. I apologize for the confusion. Chair, if I can then continue. The legislation that I'm on slide 5, the Continuing Education and Training Colleges Act has been changed to the Continuing Education and Training Act, and that act is in place. It has been reviewed. And it is only the issue of the institute that is in a process of implementation. Chair, if we can then move to the slide 7, which is dealing with the High Education Act. Chair, this is an act that has also been reviewed. It was reviewed in a collaboration between University of South Africa and also this committee dealt with the bill during the course of this year. There have been a number of changes introduced in the bill to align it with the white paper, and the long and the short, the review has been completed in terms of this legislation. It is in its final stages. That's slide number 8. The NCOP must just deal with the final approval, and then it is for enactment by the president. We have not received confirmation that it is already assigned by the president, but I can follow up on that. Chair, thank you for that information. Slide is slide 9, which is the review of the Student Financial Aid Schemes Act. Chair, as you know, this is a very critical piece of legislation. It is subjected to two sets of review. The minister has a task team which is looking at student finance modeling, and which obviously is a very important focus. This task team is still in session, and they haven't completed their work, although it is in a very advanced stage. There are still discussions with the Treasury that is outstanding. Furthermore, there's also a commission that was set up by the President, which deals with the issue of student fees or free education, which is also still in process. The policy that will result from these two different, the task team and the commission, will obviously influence any legislative changes to the National Student Financial Financial Aid Schemes Act, and it is envisaged that this piece of legislation will only be tabled in the parliamentary session of 2018, and that is also within the target set by the department for the review of the legislative framework. If I can then move to slide 10, the issue of Skills Development Act. This act is obviously a very important piece of legislation, but one of the key areas that need to be addressed is that of the CETA landscape. The CETA landscape policy is currently under review, and it is well advanced, but it is not promulgated yet. There will definitely be amendments to the legislation as a result of the policy, and it is envisaged that this bill will be tabled in Parliament during the 2018 parliamentary program for consideration. Next one is slide 11, which is dealing with the National Qualifications Framework Act. A bill has been drafted and was tabled for the 2016, but due to the municipal elections, the minister agreed to postpone the tabling of the bill. to 2017 parliamentary program. The bill has been consulted with the key role players and is scheduled to be published for public comment with due to further amendments, and it will be tabled in the parliamentary schedule for 2017. Everything is on track with that bill. Chair, the last piece of legislation that needs to be mentioned is that of the General and Further Education and Training Quality Assurance Act. This is an act which is jointly assigned to the Minister of Higher Education and Training and the Minister of Basic Education. This act has been reviewed by the department, and at this stage there were no amendments identified that is directly linked to any provisions of the white paper. Chair, it might be that as a result of some of the other policy developments that further amendments can be identified, but that will be ordinary amendments in the course of policy development and not directly linked to the white paper. That is the legislative program as envisaged. I thank you.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Again, honourable members, honourable Bazoli and honourable Kilia Nkuno. Honourable members, just before I ask you to proceed, I just got a message that I just for 5 minutes need to see the House Chair. Can I get a volunteer to sit here while I come back? No. You said no. Want to take a tea break? And I run quickly? Okay. It doesn't look like there's objection to that. I shall run as fast as I can. Let's take a break. There's some refreshments at the back also, and then this might be Honourable Kilia and Honourable Tunisa and so on. Shall we go for it?
Thank you, Chair. The concern I have is to do with the CETAs, because I understand the CETAs have been renewed until the end of 2017, but the new Act is only planned to come onto our agenda in 2018. Can you please clarify what's going on, because this sounds like a potential disaster. Thank you.
Chairperson, it happens that I also just wanted clarity about the extension of the term of the CETAs. So I'm covered by Professor Bazoli.
No, I think most of us, Chair, wanted to know about that area because we are worried seriously. We are told there is this new CETA landscape, and then the fact that their term expired, and we don't know what is happening. Again, last week, SAQA informed the committee that they have developed a policy on represented qualifications, and this will require amendment of the National Qualifications Framework. I would like to know whether the envisaged amendment has taken this into consideration. If not, why? Thank you.
Then I think the if you can answer those questions, but the following also, all legislation that you currently have, which are legislation that were crafted by the Department of Labour, and those entities, institutions, and so on, are now within your fold. one way or another, when we met with the, what is the other body's name? QCTO, same story. They are in the same category of still sitting with Department of Labor legislation, and their focus obviously have changed as they are now in the Department of Higher Education. But more worrying for that one is when we looked at their finances, we saw that the finances that they are expected to, or the monies that they are expected to finance for the programs are not necessarily within the legislative framework. And for them to even ask us for more money requires a legislative change. So if you can answer that also. And I think, yes, all the 2018 questions have been asked.
Just clarity. Remember last week we also dealt with the complexity of the qualifications, verifications, etc., from different aspects. Uma Lucy's role, CHE and all of that. If we look at the NQF Act, you know, and it appears that there's no need for the General and Further Education and Training Quality Assurance Act to be amended. But remember, we also briefly touched the issue of, is it not important to bring a greater clarity and a sort of a uniformity to the different quality assurance bodies? Now, has that been considered by the department? And if so, would there be some or other simplification of this whole system through the changes, the amendments to the NQF Act? Thank you.
Other questions?
Thank you, Chair and Honourable Members.
Chair.
Mike.
Sorry, that better. Chair, first of all, the aspect relating to the legislation and the CETA landscape in particular, Chair, the time frame of the CETA is extended to from April 2016 to end of March 2018, so it's a 2-year time frame. The legislation obviously will not be in place, and the minister extended it because of the uncertainty of the development of that policy framework. The minister will consider the position and most probably consider, or one of the options will be, to extend it also for another year in order to deal with any amendments. It is not absolutely certain that the landscape as it is currently unfolding, and Mr. Lumka can also assist in that, will need the same amount of changes as would have been required in terms of the first proposal that the minister published for comment. So it might be that the current legislation may be sufficient to deal with it, because the Act is very flexible in terms of policy and directives that the minister can determine. But, Chair, we need a policy before we can make that final determination. The long and the short is that a decision will be taken by the minister in advance, and the window of opportunity is running till the end of March, and clearly the impact of whatever decision will also be taken as part of it. I don't know if Mr. Lumka wants to add to that.
No, thanks, Chair. You are right, it's causing some uncertainty, but it's the complexity of consultation process, because the 2 years extension was meant to do a thorough consultation with all the role players. And after we received the public comments, and it emerged that the document had to be recasted, and we still need to present the final document to the minister. But Advocate Boshoff is right. We may need to advise the minister in terms of what decision needs to be taken. But it's the process of consultation with the stakeholders and the comments that we have received that have made the process to be a bit longer.
The issue the legislation that emanates from the Department of Labor. It is the Skills Development Act that we are talking about. That act has been transferred to the minister, and it deals with a number of very key structures and are dealt with in terms of a education system that has already caused changes to the bill to the act during this process. It is important that the legislation pertaining to the QCTO was caused by an amendment in 2008. Although it was done under the auspices of the Minister of Labour, the Department of Higher Education the Department of Education and the Minister of Education and the Minister of Labour had to agree in terms of the NQF Act on how to deal with the amendments of the Quality Councils. And the Quality Council for Trade and Occupation was a consequence of that negotiations. It took for more than 10 years for the two ministers to come to that, and that concept is currently in the legislation. A Chapter 6, Capital C, was introduced in the Skills Development Act. And, Chair, it is also important if you look at the Section 26G, Capital G, of that Act. It specifically provides that the QCTO is financed from money voted by Parliament for this purpose. So, Chair, it is not because of the legislative framework that they don't receive voted money. It is other dynamics. It's not the legislative framework that is causing the difficulty. Chair, the issue here is that CETA money or NQF money, not NQF, levy money, is obviously, skills levy money is obviously a source of for providing finances to all labor qualifications and training, and that is why the policy directives went that way of resourcing the QCTO. But in terms of the legislation, it is an obligation of Parliament to provide this statutory body created by Parliament to perform their functions and to also provide voted money in order to do that. So that's already been catered for. The obviously there's other sources of income also referred to. It is income earned from services rendered by it and grants or donations made to it. And it also money received from other sources, which is the levy funds, obviously that fulfill that function. Chair, the question obviously, and Mr. Lumkok can or maybe also assist in that regard, is that about the resourcing of the QCTO, obviously that is an issue that one must look into, and a decision must be taken by the relevant authorities as to is it sufficient or not. But the legislative function of a framework within which that function can be exercised and to supplement it from an array of resources is already in the legislation, and there's no need to amend the legislation in order to achieve that. Chair, the functions of the QCTO is also provided in that new section 26 capital H, which provides a whole array of functions, and what is also important, it got a very flexible portion to it in sub 6. It says the QCTO must comply with any policy determined by the minister in terms of section 26F and any written instruction by the minister in terms of sub 5. Now, Chair, it is the minister in sub 5 has the power to give a written instruction which is not inconsistent with any policy made by the minister with regard to performance of the functions of the QCTO in terms of sub 3. And sub 3 is providing, it is 8 different broad functions relating to quality performance and quality council, which is similar to what you would find comparable to the other two QCs as well. So, Chair, we have reviewed that sections, and it was the opinion of the review committee that there is no need to align it or to amend it. The flexibilities are there in order to address it. Chair, the other questions. I've written it down, but here it is. Chair, the issue of the National Qualifications Framework policy that has just been completed, or which has been published this week. Chair, it is important that one must look at the fabric and the structure of the NQF Act. The NQF Act is an interesting piece of legislation. It is a legislation which is not coming down with a sledgehammer, but more in cooperation of the different role players in order to deal with it within levels of policy frameworks that steer this framework. And it came about as a result of a concept which was that emanate from the pre the 1994. In fact, this was the first piece of legislation which the new dispensation post 1994 put in place, and that was to create a South African council, a qualification council, in order to develop this framework. Now, these different policy frameworks are relating to one another, and the one is subject to the higher hierarchy. So the minister got two levels of framework. He provides a operational policy or a remit, which is on immediate things that must be addressed on an annual basis, and then broader policy framework. The SAQWA must comply with those policy frameworks and must develop also further policy in order to implement the framework as a whole, and then it is for the different quality councils to deal with their policy frameworks in order to give effect to the two sets of frameworks above them, but in order to deal with it. And if there's any conflict, then there are a dispute mechanism in order to resolve it. So, Chair, the issue of this policy is already within the legislative framework. It is envisaged to work like that, and it is also, in our view, not necessary to amend the legislation in order to deal with it. If it was the case, then that policy could only be put into effect once the legislation comes into effect. So we are comfortable with that policy. In fact, we've got a committee where all the CEOs of the quality councils and the two departments affected, that is Department of Basic Education and the Department of Higher Education and Training, which are meeting very regularly to deal with all implementation issues relating to the NQF. And we are fully aware of all the policy developments in the various quality councils as well as in SAFWA. Chair, I don't know if my colleague wants to add to that, in our view, there is no need to amend the legislation.
No, I think we should end it there, and I think what you should rather do is you should take the concerns of the committee with regard to the 2018 aspect that you have raised here, because we hear what you say, but I don't think we are quite convinced with it, and we think it will be best if you relook those aspects of 2018. We can tell you, coming to Parliament with things which is very close to 2019 is not in your best interest, but more than that also, I think we need certainty for those institutions now, and it will be best if we can deal with the legislation. We hear what you say about consultation and all of that, but no, but we think that, you know, those things can be remedied in a much better way, Honourable Bazoli.
Thank you very much for your suggestion, because I wanted to make the same point, but maybe a little bit more strongly. I believe that this is so serious that the Minister should come and brief us on what his plans are for the CETAs. We're looking at multi-billions rands worth of money. We're looking at thousands of employees and students involved. Last time the CETAs were renewed, it was at the last minute, and it caused huge instability in the CETAs. So I would like to propose a briefing by the Minister, a summary by the Minister of what the main problems are in the comments that he's received as to why, what modifications he's going to need in his plan, a resubmission of the plan urgently, and an urgent renewal of the CETAs now for a further 2 years, because it seems to me it would be irresponsible not to renew them now, given that we know now that none of this is going to be completed in time. And to wait any longer would actually be not ethical, because we know the CETAs are not going to be, the plan is not going to be ready by the time their term of office runs out. I can't imagine how insecure the people in the CETAs must feel, knowing that in March 2018 the jobs are going to come to an end, all this waffling is going on, the things are going to close unless there's a renewal. And it seems to me the responsible thing would be to renew them now until 2020 or 2019, because we do know now that this is going to be impossible. But the briefing by the Minister, where we can ask him for his plans and his vision, I think is the most important thing.
Killian?
Chairperson, the request that you made to the department is supported, that we get further information, but that we also ask from a legal perspective, how should these institutions operate in the meantime? It has far-reaching implications to fill vacancies. How do they fill these vacancies? On a contractual basis for a period of time? So if there's a directive coming from the department to say to these CETAs, we will extend the period because we will not be concluded, but in the run-up to the deadline, the following needs to be managed very carefully. Because you see, Chair, otherwise, Professor Bazoli referred to the uncertainty, but I also want to refer to wasteful expenditure. That, you know, you keep in place specific bureaucracies to manage certain programs, and then the output, how many of these students are actually coming out of the system with qualifications that can put them back in work. My concern is, for as long as we proceed with this uncertainty, we will not see the results. And that is a very serious concern.
I mean, if we can't manage the outcomes of these CETAs well, and we cannot direct them how they should make the necessary appointments, fill critical vacancies, but not all, because it's now going to be readjusted. Else, what is going to happen? Are we going to have 21 CETAs with 21 bureaucracies to collapse in 8 or 12 and with excessive, you know, staff complements, etc.? Those practical considerations need to come as part of a presentation to this committee. How do we manage this process? Also from a legal perspective. Thank you, Chairperson.
I want to ask honourable members that part of what you said, we're going to have the cafeteria now, and I think maybe some of the things that you are saying, let's just hear what they are also saying. We might want to add more things to our resolution. So let's keep some of this in abeyance, but let's hear the cafeteria also. And we will certainly follow up in a letter to the minister about our request that we are making in this regard of the CETAs, and I think the others also. May I thank you very much for the presentation. We now ask the CETA to address us.
Thank you very much, Chairperson.
We have two microphones on. I was not confused who's going to speak. And if you can introduce the delegation.
Thanks, Chairperson, and thanks to the honourable members for affording us an opportunity to present the CETA annual report for the financial year 2015-2016. With me is the management team from CETA. Next to me is Ms. Kitumetsi Pepane, who is the executive manager responsible for learning programs. And I'm also having Mr. Malusi Shezi, who is the chief financial officer just behind me here. And next to him is the chief of operations, Mr. Sabelo Silinga. That's the team from CETA. Chairperson, thanks very much once more. I see the slides are not up. The presentation has got three sections. The first section just deals with an overview. That's a part of the presentation that I will take, and followed by the performance information section, which Mrs. Pepane will talk to. And then the last section is the presentation of the annual financial statements, which will be tabled by the CFO. Just taking into consideration the context of CETA administration and the progress made thus far, I thought it was going to be helpful to just indicate that, as honourable members are aware, the CETA was placed under administration in October 2014, and coming on board, one had to familiarise himself as an administrator with the challenges that have led the CETA to be put under administration. And central to that was the engagement with stakeholders to understand their concerns, but also for them to outline from their perspective what they thought the challenges of the organization were, and also link that with the findings of the Auditor General that had led the CETA to have a qualified audit opinion for the financial year ended 2013-2014.
having put in place that plan to address all of those issues both raised by the stakeholders, but also the findings of the Auditor General, enabled us to move to a phase of building the organization, addressing all of those issues that we ourselves had identified by the stakeholders and the auditors themselves. And between October 2014 and March 2015, we were able to at least make significant progress in terms of improving the performance of the CETA, but also obtaining an unqualified audit opinion. Immediately thereafter, we then said it is time that within that particular financial year that was beginning in April 2015, we moved towards stabilizing the organization. Central to it was to understand the skills mix in the organization in relation to the mandate of the organization, which then allowed us to ensure that looking at the skills that existed within the organization at that point, we needed to match those skills with the job requirements within the CETA, but also where necessary, embark on training and development of staff so that you then begin to capacitate the organization. To date, we've been able to achieve a number of those milestones that we have set ourselves, including repositioning the organization, because the last time I was here, Honorable Chairperson, I indicated that we had to, as part of trying to realign and position the organization, review the programs that were 14 at that point, wherein ultimately we came up with 4 programs, and we also needed to ensure that the structure itself of the organization is aligned to those programs so that we then deliver on the mandate. We're at a point now where, after having re-established the organization, filled at least about 87% of the positions in the organization, at a senior management level, it's only the position of the CEO that has not yet been filled. Interviews have been conducted, recommendations have been made. The minister is in the process of tabling that particular appointment before cabinet, because it is a cabinet requirement and appointment. So we have interviewed also for the CEO. So the management is in place. Critical positions in the organization have been filled to ensure that the organization does fulfill its mandate. We have recently advertised for the nomination of members to form the accounting authority, which is the board of the organization. So our intention really is to make sure that early next year that process is completed. Those nominations will be closing end of this month, and we'll then be embarking on a process of taking that process further towards the completion. Now, in terms of bringing about measures that aimed at improving the performance and operational management of the organization, we had streamlined the discretionary grant administration process from a tranche-based system to a performance-based system. We had a situation where we will be processing payments to training providers in the form of tranches, and we discovered that as part of the assessment of what has been happening previously, is that if you look at the learner dropout, you will have a high rate of learner dropout, but you'll have invested more money in terms of your tranche payment. So we needed to put in place, again, mechanisms of ensuring that the output in terms of the number of learners that go through the system and actually succeed increases. And we then created the necessary conditions for the training providers themselves to perform, and we reward them for performing. We also improved the alignment of the windows. We have the first and the second window, wherein we put out an advert for the potential and possible training providers to actually apply. We then needed to make sure that that is aligned with the training interventions that are in our space. We also introduced an independent and transparent grant disbursement system, and this is primarily informed by the fact that as part of stakeholder engagement, it became clear that there were suspicions that our processes were not transparent, but also over a period of time, there was also a likelihood that you would have the same training providers being allocated, regardless of the fact that you still have those that are emerging, in particularly in your rural provinces, who want to train but not being allocated. So we just needed to make sure that that process is independent and that its integrity is sort of preserved. We also introduced a web-based electronic discretionary grant application system so that applications are no longer done manually. You are able to do and fill your application. If you are in Cape Town, you don't need to courier any document, so that our systems begin to be responsive, begin to be effective, and are sort of enabling in terms of ensuring that people are able to utilize time effectively. We also went further to, in terms of stakeholders and partnerships, to spend $36 million to create 809 and 300 placement opportunities for TVET and university graduates, respectively. This will relate, in the main, to learners that will have gone through TVET, but from a point of view of work, integrated learning or internship, if, for instance, we had to take university learners, learners struggling to get those opportunities. So we needed to establish consciously those kind of interventions. We also have a standing partnership with the National Department of Tourism around the issue of career opportunities within the tourism sector. And we also, together with that department, in a form of a partnership, did a skills audit to understand the skills requirements and needs of the sector. In terms of improving the organizational performance, honorable members will recall that when we reported here, we indicated that the performance of the organization had dropped significantly to 34%. So we've been able to, during this period of administration, move that performance from 34% to 80%. And my apologies for the typo. It's not 70%. It's supposed to be 80%. Between the financial years 2013, 2014, and 2015, 2016. There's also been an acknowledgement of the improvement in terms of our sector skills plans through the research that we conduct that is intensive, but also the level of strategic plan and our annual performance plan as a result of the improvement in the sector skills plans has significantly improved. We've also improved the integrity, as acknowledged by the Auditor General, in terms of the performance information, both from a point of view of reliability, but also the usefulness of the data. And as a result of those measures that were taken in place, we're able to obtain a clean audit for the financial year 2015-2016. We further partnered with the Human Sciences Research Council to conduct a labor market assessment for the three subsectors, the arts and culture and heritage, gaming and lotteries, as well as sports, recreation and fitness. And it's very important because we needed to make sure that the interventions, again, in line with what we're doing with the National Department of Tourism, respond to the needs within these particular sectors in terms of the skills gap that have been identified. We also started our own internship program. Within CATSITA, we didn't have an internship program. We will find internship programs with the other employers that are within our space. So we started our own internship program in the 14-15 financial year, 15-16 financial year, and we recruited 24 interns. To date, we have been able to, as a CITA, to absorb 13 of those interns. 5 of those interns left before the program ended for better opportunities in the workplace, and 3 of those that could not be absorbed were also absorbed in the recent months within AVIS current term. We have completed the realignment of the structure, as I've indicated, so that it's aligned to the strategy. We have filled those positions within the CITA, especially the critical positions, and 87%, as I've indicated, has been filled. We've also introduced a performance-based system within the organization to build a culture of performance, but also we're intending to extend that to training providers so that there is some mechanism of rewarding and recognizing those that are performing very well, so that we also encourage competitiveness, we encourage commitment amongst our stakeholders. Now, centrally to the organizational development process, when we're designing the structure, the intention was really to ensure that as a sector we're accessible and we're closer to where our stakeholders are. And you will recall that when we came to this house last time, we indicated that we are only operating from Gauteng, and to date, we're proud to say that we have a national footprint where in currently we have 6 regional offices covering 9 provinces, and those are located in TVET colleges in line with the department's commitment of strengthening TVET colleges. So those regional offices, you would have one here in the Western Cape, currently located at False Bay College, but permanently will be located next year at False Bay College, because there are some renovations that are taking place as we speak, and this year, December, they will be ready to move to Northlink College, because all our programs are located in the False Bay, in the Northlink campus that is here in Plattekloof. So we will be having offices that are going to be open there on the 1st of December, but currently they are operating at False Bay College at Westlake. In the Eastern Cape, we've got offices at Lovedale College in King Williamstown. And the intention really in all the provinces is to make sure that we have an office, and then the mid to long term plan is to have satellite offices because of the geographical spread of our provinces. If, for instance, you take a province as big as Eastern Cape, it will be helpful to have an office probably in Amtata, which is a satellite office, as well as an office in PE. So those are in plan, but will roll out as time goes by. So our view is that these regional offices will improve stakeholder access and promote effective delivery of our services, because now stakeholders would not necessarily need to either travel or call the Johannesburg office. The services will be here at their doorstep. So on that note, Chairperson, I would hand over to Ms. Kitumisi Pebane to take the committee through the performance report.
Good morning, honorable members of the Portfolio Committee, ladies and gentlemen, colleagues in the House. I will be taking you through the performance report of 2015 to 2016 financial year. In the year under review, the CETA had 75 key performance areas. In terms of achievement, over 13 indicators were achieved at over 100%, 38 indicators achieved at 100%, 6 indicators achieved between 75 to 99%, 7 indicators achieved between 50 to 74%, and 11 indicators achieved between 0 to 49%. And the following slides will then give an explanation. The CAT-CETA has 4 main programs, mainly being administration, governance, planning, and learning programs. In terms of administration overall, we have achieved 60%. In terms of governance, at this point, we have achieved 75%. In terms of planning, 100% of the targets were met. And in terms of learning programs, 22 of the 34 KPIs were achieved at 65%. The following slides will therefore zoom now into the learning programs. And just to provide context to the members, these programs are funded through the discretionary grant process, which is really aligned to the grant regulations of 2012. And the grant regulations of 2012 is really underpinned by principles of transparency, access, and fairness. And as a result, the CETA has put in a policy to ensure that that is upheld. And in terms of our discretionary grant windows, we have various committees that ensure that the process is fair. We've got a bid evaluation committee that views all applications from our employer and employer constituencies. We've got our adjudication committee before final approval. Now, zooming into the specific learning programs, starting with learnerships, you will note that with employed learners in learnerships, we achieved 99% of our targets, 99%. From the target of 200, 198 was achieved. With regards to the completion, the target was 100, 399 target was achieved. And this can be attributed to mainly the learners rolling over from the previous years. Honorable Chair, you can recall that the last time that we came to present, there were various projects that were on hold and that the CETA had to regularize. And as a result, these were only reported in the 2015-2016 financial year. And that has attributed to the high numbers of completion, and which you will see in the following slides as well. When you look into unemployed learners entering learnership programs, our target was 400, and what was achieved is 690 at 173%. Under unemployed learners completing learnership programs, our target was 200 and our achievement was 300. Also important to note is that learnership programs are over a period of 12 months. And as part of the training program, we accommodate what we call remedial program for what you may call slow learners or learners who may need more time to understand, which therefore will mean that instead of programs taking a strict 12 months, they would invariably roll over into the following year. When we zoom into artisans and internship, our target was 100 and we have successfully achieved our target at 100%. Number of artisans completing, our target was 50. We achieved at 89%, and this again can be contributed to the completion and the time frame of the program. Number of unemployed learners entering internship programs, our target was 320, and we successfully achieved the target. With regards to unemployed learners completing internship programs, our target was 260, we achieved 126, and the achievement is 48%. Again, this is attributed to the length of the program. Our internship program are 12 months to ensure that all the university students have sufficient time and understand the key requirements in the workplace. With respect to bursaries, our target was 350 and we achieved 498. Chair, if you look into our funding model as CETA, you find that we have kept all our bursaries at 67,000. However, with the number of universities, they are different funding models. For example, you may find that one university would fund at 40,000, which means that there is change left, a surplus for the CETA. The CETA has then taken a decision to therefore say, with the money, instead of taking it back, let us ensure that more learners are funded. And it was also a strategic decision for the CETA as part of the fees must fall movement and contribution to that as a strategic project. With regards to number of learners completing bursaries, our target was 175, and what was achieved is 133 learners. Skills programs, our target for the year was 1,500, and again, our achievement is 5,551. And one may say this is quite a huge variation. But as I have indicated before, there were a number of projects from the before administration that were on hold that needed to be regularized, and accordingly, and in order for the learners to be able to receive certificates, they need to be completed. And these learners were therefore reported in the 15 and 16 financial year to ensure that all our learners have certificates accordingly. In terms of completion, our target was 750, and what was completed was 1,545 at 206%. With regards to TVET colleges, these are specific learners from the TVET colleges in our six subsectors. Our target was 1,200 and we achieved 804. And the reduction can be really attributed to the throughput of the number of learners from the TVET colleges. I think of recent there has been a lot of media coverage on this issue and a report that has been compiled which really would provide an explanation to the throughput. The reasons for variance, honourable members, as I have indicated earlier, is the CETA took a decision to ensure that the strategic project that will increase contribution to the increased delivery. The CETA therefore also ensured that projects that were on hold in the previous years are reported and as a result completed in the year under review. In the 15-16 financial year, the slide shows the various provincial distribution for the various learnership learning programs. You will see that in terms of our distribution, you had about 906 allocated to Gauteng, 470 allocated to Western Cape, 328 allocated to KZN, 295 allocated to Limpopo, 112 allocated to Free State, 131 allocated to Northwest, 347 allocated to the Eastern Cape, Mpumalanga has 114, Northern Cape has 20%. And the rationale behind the split is you need to look into the infrastructure that is available for placement of learners, for example. You therefore need to make sure that there are schools or universities in that vicinity. There are employers, and these employers are able to place the learners. In more rural areas, you do have that uneven distribution where you don't have employers close to the universities, the TVET colleges, or that they have capacity to deliver. With regards to the Northern Cape, you will find that a number of learners from the Northern Cape migrate to other provinces. For example, if you sit with the University of Pretoria or even the Western Cape University, they will tell you we've got a substantial amount of learners from the Western Cape. So this does not mean that learners were Northern Cape, that learners were not funded. However, learners funded migrated to a different region, and they therefore use the address, which is the university address, to be able for registration. Reasons for variance, I've really touched on a number of that, but it will be an uneven distribution of service providers and training providers. You do find that most of our service providers and training providers predominantly are in urban areas. And only now the CETA is putting in place intervention to ensure that even training providers in the more rural areas are equally capacitated to be able to offer our programs. There is still a strong element of migration from rural to urban provinces because there's this notion that there are no opportunities in more rural areas but they're in urban. But with the regional offices being put in place, we are in a process of ensuring that there is awareness, that learners understand that within their very respective provinces, there are opportunities and there is programs allocated. You still find that there is still a high dropout rate share in all programs. Another element is the learner throughput from TVET colleges and a low intake on TVET programs as well as participation by employers in smaller regions. Again, Chair, you will find that the regional offices at the moment are hard at work to ensure that we no longer have most of these problems like participation. They are mobilizing employers, ensuring that employers comply to the CETA processes, ensuring that the employers know how to access programs, ensuring that also learners are aware that there is a CETA and this is the function. If you look into the provincial targets for 2016-17, Chair, this is the time where the CETA has really spread its wings and ensured that there is a regional footprint. You will therefore see that it's a very different picture from the earlier slide of 15-16. You will see that in Gauteng, our allocation is 407, Western Cape 420, KZN 392, Limpopo 676, Free State 761, Northwest 734, Eastern Cape 923, Mpumalanga 680, and Northern Cape we've got 504. This is our allocation, and as we are advertising our discretionary grant, we really ensure and our very best to ensure that these allocations are really upheld, that employers from those specific regions are capacitated. Chair, as alluded to earlier, we do have the six regional offices in Free State and Northern Cape at the TVET colleges in particular, and this was a strategic decision as CAT-CETA to ensure that we align ourselves with the white paper to partner with these TVET colleges. Eastern Cape, we're sitting at Lovedale. Gauteng, we are in CAT-CETA. Western Cape, we're in Northlink. KZN in Itikwini. Limpopo and Mpumalanga, we are at the Capricorn TVET College. Moving on, Chair, to the next element where we're talking about servicing our training providers. Training providers are various private organizations who apply for accreditation at the CETA to be able to provide qualifications that are accredited and which are credit aligned. In the year under review, 52 applications were received and 17 employers were accredited. You find that from the 52, a number of providers did not proceed to the next application phase, which you call phase B. In terms of program approval, we received 167 applications. Only 74 were approved. And this is because in most cases, the employers do not really meet the minimum requirements to be accredited or to even have program approval. For example, among others, we would look for your program strategy, your learner guide, facilitator guide. In absence of those, you cannot even have effective training in the sector. So as a result of that, that reduced our target from 167 to 74. Again, Chair, on an annual basis, CAT-CETA does have roadshows to ensure that the training providers are capacitated, they are refreshed and are aware of what the requirements are of the CETA. From assessors, we receive application for both assessor and moderators on a yearly basis. We received 323 new applications. From the 323 applications, 233 were new assessors that were registered, and we, in addition, received 455 re-registrations. Another reason for deviation would be, at times, we do not really receive sufficient information to be able to register a person as an assessor. Another element is the person needs to be a subject matter expert to be able to be an assessor of a certain program. This really minimizes the risk in the industry. In terms of our moderators, 159 new applications were received, 85 were registered, and 106 were re-registrations. With that, thank you very much, Chair, from my side. We'll move to the next presentation.
Chairperson of the committee, members of the committee, my colleagues, all protocols observed. Good day. I'm going to be taking the committee through the financial statements presentation as included in the annual report of CATSITA for 15-16 and also touch base on the 2016 and 17-18 budget that is planned to cover the targets that just been presented in the previous presentation. Chairperson, before I get into the details of the figures that we're going to present, I just needed to highlight certain legislative requirements that governs how we should manage our expenditures and our revenue. As a norm for all the sitters, the main revenue stream we get it from the levy contributions from the employers whose annual salary bill per annum exceeds 500,000, which in terms of the Skills Development Levies Act, they have to contribute 1% of that amount. And then the CETA, in terms of grant regulations of 2012, gazetted in 2013, and Skills Development Act and Skills Development Levies Act is required to allocate 20% of what is received from the levy contributions goes to the National Skills Fund, and then to incentivize the employers themselves who have contributed after meeting all the due requirements, you have to return back 20% as per grant regulations of 2013. And the bulk of the monies that we receive as a CETA, 49.5% of that need to be spent on discretionary projects or expenses, which is talking to the key mandate of this of the CETAs. And then we have to use maximum of 10.5% of the budget or of what we have received to fund our administration, which is covering the resources that we need to be able to execute our mandate and achieve our targets. Then out of the 49.5%, we also got a legislation that says 80% of that should be spent in pivotal allocated to pivotal spending, which is funding the projects that lead to a formal qualification, and then 20% can be used at discretion for those that might not lead necessarily to a formal qualification. And also as part of that 49%, as well as there may be other administrative costs that are allocated there, that they shouldn't exceed 7.5. In essence, to give that, we need to make sure that most of that budget is used specifically to the skills development. Just to highlight, as you'll see with as we go further with our figures, CATSITA is still being challenged due to its sectoral structural design to meet the targets or the thresholds of 10.5%, whereby you find that we are required to have resources to be able to discharge our mandate. But then in terms of being able to be within those limits, we're having a challenge due to the fact that the sector itself is comprised of very few training or employers that are able to have a salary bill of above 500,000 a year. And most of the players in the sector, you find that are SMEs that are not necessarily paying that amount of money. Hence, as a result, the revenue you get sometimes is not directly matched to the expenditures or that we need to be able to even be able to execute our strategy to achieve one target. Next slide, then we start to talk about the numbers. In terms of preparing our financial statements, we're using standards of GRAP, which is General Recognized Accounting Practice, as prescribed by the Accounting Standards Board. And then the statement of financial position shows what we own and control and what we owe to other service providers and other parties. In this slide, we just summarized those material and significant figures. We didn't include everything that is shown in the statement of financial position. It's the same as well with other components of financial statements. Under assets, we're just highlighting there what we have as receivables, what we are being owed at year end. In 2016, we're sitting with 4.6 million, and then in terms of the cash reserves to be able to service our obligations at year end, we were sitting with 255 million. And in terms of our liabilities, the payables and other provisions, for the payables we're sitting at 58.3 million and other provisions we're sitting at 8.4 million. Then the reserves, which also talks to what the 95% of what we should have committed or spent at year end, being the main one being the discretionary grant reserve, we were sitting at 290 million. Then I will move to the next component, which is the statement of financial performance, formerly known as the income statement. This slide talks now to that first slide that we shown, that shows the percentages of how much we should be spending. On the revenue side, from the 1% levy contributions, we got non-exchange revenues, which is mainly the revenue driven by legislation. For the current year that we reported on, 2016, we received about 305 million. And then on exchange revenue, which was mainly investment income, which is interest that we earned on the cash balances we were having at the bank, we earned about 11.3 million, which resulted in 316.4 million revenue for the year. Then when we go to the expenditure side, and then on employer grant and project expenses, which is what we should be spending most of our monies on, we spent 206 million for the current year. And then on administrative expenses, we spent 68.5 million. And other expenses, which were just minor, where is the loss on disposal of assets, those assets that were all some broken that needed to be scrapped off. You have in accounting, you have to account for the carrying value versus what you're receiving, of which it resulted in 74,000, resulting in a paper net surplus of 41.8 million. I think in this slide you see administrative expenses if you were to count that in terms of the percentages, but we'll see in the next slide where we're matching the revenue that the percentages are not necessarily 10.5% as legislated. The next slide is showing the revenue split into different items. For 2016, under discretionary, there was 183 million, and then administration, 39.9 million. I will move then to the slide that matches the revenue expenditure. As you'll see there, on the discretionary grant side, on that revenue versus expenditure, as a CETA, we're doing well. We're within the thresholds. The challenge that you'll see in that is that the revenue for that is allocated to cover the administrative cost is not sufficient, as you'll see that it's sitting almost at 40 million, whereas our actual admin expenditure is sitting at 68 million. That challenge is the one that I highlighted at the beginning of my presentation, to say that the structural design of the sector that we're in is contributing mainly to that factor. I will then move to the next component of financial statements, being the statement of changes in net assets. The main reserve that we're showing, which is key, is the discretionary grant reserve that we saw in the statement of financial position, sitting at 190.4 million. And in total, in our reserves, we're sitting at 194 million. Then I will move to the cash flow statement. The cash flow statement being the main statement that shows the actual cash flows, whereas the others will include certain things that are just paper-based due to the requirements of the accounting standards. From what we pay during the year, being the net cash flow from operating activities, it shows that we paid actually about 62 million. Then from investing activities, which will be the buying, the sale, and the disposal of assets, we had an outflow of 842,000. And then from financing activities, which is the payment of other obligations, like the things of finance leases, we had an outflow of 314,000, resulting in the net increase in cash and cash equivalent of about 61 million. At the beginning of the year, we had a cash balance of 194 million resulting at year end for us, showing at the in our bank balance 255 million. Then in terms of the grant regulations, the PFMA and the SDA, we required also to show the commitments, which is a CETA-specific disclosure requirements, where we show all the commitments we have with the training providers and employers that we have signed contract for the skills development purposes. And it's in the next slide. We're showing there the commitments that we had at the end of the year. The most important thing there is that we're required to have, out of the monies that we have received, the 49.5%, we have committed about 95% of that at the end of the financial year. Otherwise, if there are no obligating reasons, it has to be handed over to the National Skills Fund. And then we can also retain about 5% of what is uncommitted. From what we had commitments at year end, we had about 146 million in total, which is matched to the discretionary grant reserve of 190.4 million, which is a better picture compared to last year, meaning we were not over committed. Our reserves are able to cover our commitments that we have, that we still had to service at year end. And also that is matched to sufficient cash reserves, which indicates that if our employers and training providers came to our doors following our performance-based management system, showing that we have trained people, this is the evidence, we have complied with the covenants of the agreements we signed with you, we can be able to pay them immediately from those reserves that we had at year end. Just to highlight on this one, as I indicated, that we required also, if we have not committed 95% and above 5%, to hand over to the National Skills Fund. If not, we have to request the National Treasury to give the grant to roll over the surpluses. All those processes were followed, whereby we provided the reasons of things that the CETA still need to do as part of completing the turnaround and also improving the systems internally. And then we got the approval to retain that cash surplus that we're showing in our books before the financial statement process was finalized in 31st July. We got the response from Treasury by June. And then moving to next, in terms of the Section 55 of the PFMA, we're required to disclose any material losses or any expenditure that might have been incurred not following the processes as outlined in the PFMA and the Treasury regulations and other acts. I think in this picture, I would like to highlight a few things coming from the past and where we are currently. Looking at 2016 versus 2015, in 2015 we still had about 79 million, which was our opening balance, which talked to certain issues that happened in the past, some of them which were the reason why the CETA went into administration, whereby certain things were done without the approval of the board, or whereby certain expenditures were incurred not following the proper processes. And then what the CETA had to do was to make sure that we strengthen our financial controls and also the compliance culture in the organization. And where necessary, after doing all the inquiries on the matters, we have to do the due processes whereby, if it's within the ambit of the accounting authority, having the administrator to condone those expenditures, and where they need the National Treasury to get involved to get the condonation, all those processes had to be followed. If you look at the picture starting where we started at the beginning of the year, we were sitting at 79.3 million, and at the end of the year, we were sitting at 1.3 million, which is a 98% improvement in that picture. I would also like to highlight, maybe as in terms of a definition in section one of what the irregular expenditure is, of the PFMA being the irregular expenditure incurred not following the processes as outlined, that this expenditure itself is an indicator of certain weaknesses that came from the past, but whereby the CETA still had an obligations to be serviced. Like, for instance, you'll see certain items are written under non-compliance to SDM prescripts and deviations, which were old training contracts that were signed in the past, whereby you find that the employers have trained learners, and then the only thing that was not done properly internally in the CETA in the past were following those due processes, then those has to be regularized so that the outcomes from those training programs can be reported accordingly. And there is administration expenditure in excess of thresholds, which is sitting at 27.9 million. That's the expenditure that I highlighted at the beginning of my presentation, that currently the structural setup of the CETA is unable to be within the 10.5% threshold. Then the requirement in that regard, if you have anything that is exceeding 10.5% of the threshold in your admin expenditure, you need to get the ministers or the executive authorities' approval for whatever is above. So the CETA has to indicate that in this disclosure note, and then get the proper authorization in advance, which usually happens on the 15th of November, just 6 months during the current year. So that those steps were all done during the financial year, last year, and then the necessary approval was obtained from the minister in this regard. And with regard to all other irregular expenditure items, the condonations were done internally, and then we have to also do the submission of these figures to National Treasury to go through them, indicating what led to these items being irregular, and also who was responsible, and submit the supporting documents talking to those facts. We did all the necessary processes. We did the submissions to Treasury at year end. Then Treasury has to go through the supporting documents and then give an indication whether they agree with you that these should be condoned or not. And then we got the due condonation from National Treasury as well, after they have satisfied themselves from the supporting documentation that were provided that these were not necessarily fraudulent expenditures that are not supposed to be condoned, but it were issues of the processes not being followed in the past. And then the balance that we're having at end of July, still sitting at 1.39, it's also all those submissions were still with Treasury, because they're going through all the batches that were submitted, so that process was not finalized. And then I will then move on to the next slide of fruitless and wasteful expenditure, which is showing a 78% improvement, whereby in last year we incurred about 419,000, and showing the areas which we had issues, and this in the current year we only had 89,000, which is a significant improvement. If we look at the description of those, it were the matters that were not within the control of the organization, whereby we need to support our TVET the lecturers, and then we send them to certain programs, and we have to book and incur certain costs. But then certain operational requirements happened at the colleges, which resulted in lecturers not coming to the training, but the expenditure has already been incurred, and we had to disclose those as such. So in the slide, there was nothing that was within the control of the organization. Then I will move on to the audit outcomes slide, which shows our journey from the financial year just before the administration, during the administration. In 2013-14, as was highlighted in the administrator's presentation, and then which led also in that year, the CETA going to administration, we got a qualified audit opinion with various issues. And then in 2014, there was a significant improvement that within a space of few months from October to 31st March, the organization worked to make sure that certain things that were led to a qualifications were addressed, and resulted in an unqualified audit opinion with emphasis of matter. And then in 2015-16, we got a clean audit opinion, which in which, in terms of the OAG reporting framework, as we move to the next slide, the AG is required in terms of the Public Audit Act to report on the financial statements and on other compliance and reporting requirements, which include reporting on performance information. And then on financial statements, we got about four opinions, which is unqualified, meaning the financial statements do not contain any material misstatements and errors. Or if it's qualified, it means the financial statements contain material misstatements and omissions. And then there is another aspect, which is emphasis of matter, whereby the auditor is required to highlight certain matters disclosed in the annual report or in the financial statements of an organization if they feel that is more important to bring to the attention of the readers of that financial statements and annual report, and also a disclaimer. So looking at what we got in this slide in the current year, there are other emphases of matter which are not necessarily an indicator of anything negative. That the other one being that the CETA is still under administration, as is a fact. The issue of the CETA license expiring in 31st March 2018, which might have impact on the going concern going forward. And the restatement of prior year figures whereby certain errors might have been identified. These ones were identified by the CETA itself, not through the audit process. Hence, the certain figures from 15-14 financial year were restated to show the correct treatment that was supposed to have been effected in the previous years. Then, under compliance, which is the requirement of the Public Audit Act, the AG indicated that there were no matters of material non-compliance. As I read, if you read the annual report on page 65, he did not identify any instances of material non-compliance with specific matters in key legislation as set out in general notice issued in terms of the Public Act. Then reporting on our internal controls as well, the AG indicated that he did not identify any significant deficiencies in internal controls. And in other reports, then they have issues of investigation that was undertaken by the CETA from the alleged allegations that certain monies earmarked for mandatory grants, refunds, the 20% were channeled to the private or personal bank account of the officials between period 2010 and 2014. That investigation was completed in May, and the results of that indicated that indeed, factually, certain or former employees of the organization channel the money to their own private account. And then I would like also to highlight that on this matter, we did our own exercises internally to make sure that the financial systems are enhanced, and also running through the test to make sure there are no similar incurrences in the current year of 15-16, that whereby the monies are shown on the face value as paid to supply X, whereas they went elsewhere, and there were no indicators of such. So this matter is still in court, and then the judgment is going to be passed, I think, soon before end of this month, because the perpetrator appeared in court in September, and then we hear that the person pleaded guilty.
I suggest that you stop there, because the next two pages, I mean, we can really go through that ourselves.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much for the presentation, honourable members. There is the presentation from the CETA, Honourable Mtunu, your hand is up. Zuela, Killian, I noted all your hands.
Thank you, Chair. I want to thank the CETA for the presentation. Firstly, I want to commend them for the clean audit and how they have reduced on irregular expenditure. I am worried, though, with the over expenditure on Program 1 and 2. But again, there is non-achievement of targets. In your Program 1, you had 25, you achieved 15, 10 not achieved. Program 2, there is 8, 6 achieved, 2 not achieved, but you have overspent by millions. For Program 1, it's 28.2, Program 2, 15.8 million. Program 4. I'm so worried with this one. I'm looking at your page 39. I'm saying this is your key focus area because it's skills development. This is why the CETA exists in the main, skills development. Where you have recorded an underspending of 72.9 million. Your core delivery program, you are underspending on your core delivery program. Yes, we have achieved a clean audit, but we are not delivering on the key program. It's skills development. That is why we've got CETAs. We want to develop skills. And if you are not giving us that, it's not helping us. I want to know what could be the reason for this one. And Chair, I'm not good with mathematics, but I was just looking at these columns on your page 39. The first one, Program 1, where there's administrations, there's 39.578 million. And then there would be sub-programs. I believe that it is this 39 million which has been distributed according to these sub-programs. But when you add that 17 plus 2 plus 3 plus 1 plus 1, it doesn't come to the 39. Maybe I'm not good with mathematics. Then you go back to your skills development, the first column, where there is 222.066. Again, it's the same thing. Maybe you will explain it better. But those figures do not tally. But if you are looking at them horizontally, they will give you that over expenditure and under expenditure that is being highlighted there. But if you go into the sub-programs totaling, it doesn't add up. I would like to know what criteria is used to determine allocations for bursaries, internships, and learnerships. On the presentation that was done by the Miss, I forgot the first name. Yes, Pebane, yes. It's just, I'm afraid that I'll say the wrong thing. That's why I was not afraid. On your page 10, where there is provincial distribution for 2015 bursaries, learnerships, internships, there, your distribution seems to be centralized in Gauteng and Western Cape. You give more there. I don't know, maybe there is a specific reason for you to do that, but I'm looking at areas where there is a dire need of skills development. They not appear to be favored in your allocations. Maybe you have a better explanation. And again, on your skills development, your key program, you are saying we have underspent, but if we're looking at the figures there, they are not appealing. It's not impressive where you are targeting so just small numbers, and then you underspend. The last one, I would like to know whether has the CETA been able to recoup the money that was utilized to pay for international trips and university fees for the former board members' families? If not, why? Thank you so much.
Kubisa.
Thank you so much. I just wanted to know whether all the critical posts have been filled, because that is important. I heard the presenter saying that perhaps it's the position of the CEO at a senior level that is left unfilled. I wanted to find out whether there are any other positions. Then, secondly, I'm also on the issue of the provincial targets for for bursaries. I had to put a question mark on this one because I noted, for instance, that Eastern Cape has 120 for 2016-2017, and then you come to KwaZulu-Natal, then it is 30, and Gauteng is 30. So that was my worry because, I mean, when you look at the Eastern Cape, for instance, there is always an outcry for skills development. And of course, the province is sparsely populated. And I just wanted to know what's happening there. And also, there is somewhere where I saw something about funding, whereby with regard to skills program for 2015-2016, CETA funded number of learners entering skills, 500, non-CETA funded. I just wanted to get clarity on that one because I see CETA funded is 500 and then this non-CETA funded is 1,000. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson, and let me also follow the suit and welcome the presentation and also applaud the CETA for obtaining the clean audit opinion. My first question will be on the regions that have been established in the provinces. The CETA established six regions, and of which, out of nine provinces, some of the provinces have to share these regions. That is your Free State and Northern Cape combined together, and Gauteng and Northwest, Limpopo and Mpumalanga sharing those offices. And when I check, I just want to understand or to check with you whether the regions that do not have offices also receive the adequate support, and how many staff members are employed for each region and their salary band. My second question again will be when the department has previously reported to the committee that the Western Cape has challenged the DPSA directive and there was a process to resolve the legislative around the directive. Is the non-compliance by the government departments and public entities as a result of the unresolved legalities with the directive? And what is the progress with regard to the resolving of these challenges? The last one, during the committee midterm review workshop which was held with the SANBI, we were informed as the committee that SANBI was not paying its 30% contribution to CAF CETA because the CETA was not providing funding for training in skills interventions, which will address the skill shortage in the biodiversity and conservation sectors. Could it be that some of the public entities are not contributing to the CETA because they do not get value for money? Has the CETA over-provided a report to any of the paying departments or public entity on the utilization of their contribution? If so, how often and what has been the response? I'll stop here, Chairperson. Thank you very much.
Honourable Member, Honourable Bazoli.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you. Congratulations on your clean audit. I'd like to join in that. When a CETA or any other organisation goes into administration, one of the things we never get is some sense of what's actually been done by the administrator to fix it up. So although we can indirectly get a sense that things are improving in the CETA, we don't actually know what the administrator found and what has been done about it so that it won't recur. We hear that there's one fraud investigation, but I presume that in order for an organization to be put under administration, there needs to have been more than one fraud accusation made. So could you give us a sense of, well, how much corruption did you find and what has been done about it and how many people were fired and how many were prosecuted? Then an example of the kind of corruption that occurs in CETAs that I've certainly seen is in the handing out of tenders for providing skills training. And sometimes the people to whom those tenders are handed out are fraudulent. They don't actually ever provide the skills. And there is a very worrying figure here where under skills programs, your slide says 5,551 people were entered the skills programs, but only 1,545 graduated from those programs. Now, I know not all those programs were yours. You only had 1,000. Nevertheless, it does seem to suggest that there's something funny going on in those skills providers because so many people are going into the programs, getting bursaries, but not actually qualifying. And I wonder if you could comment on that. Is this a sign that there's something fraudulent going on there? The last one is... I'll just leave it at those two. There's only one fraud investigation. What more was there? And is this 5,500 coming down to 1,500 an example of fraud?
Killian? Thanks, Chairperson. Chairperson, I would like to align myself with the others to say that it is good that at least from a governance point of view, the CFO and Ms. Bhavani's presentations were good because it looks like they're doing the right things, and thanks to the administrator for picking up and getting the house of CETA in order. Just a general concern, members have referred to that, and that is the non-payment of levies. Now, what is the CETA doing about it? If I look at the list of non-paying entities, it is huge. And these are, in many respects, national departments, but also provincial departments. There's no reason, apparent reason, why the Eastern Cape Department of Sport, Recreation, Arts and Culture is not paying. Environmental Affairs, National Department, non-paying. Arts and Culture, National Department, non-paying. Trade and Industry, Gaming Sector, non-paying. Free State Department of Environment, Affairs and Tourism, I can go on like that. The point is, I would like to know, on the one hand, we have a shortfall in terms of levies coming in, but on the other hand, we have an overexpenditure in terms of the regulated split, expenditure on administration, on costs, etc. If the CETA is currently overexpending on those programs and additional money comes in, how sure can we be that those additional funds will in fact be directed for its main key purpose, and that is skills training? Honorable Kunu has already referred to that if we look at the performance targets met, those are the most critical ones that they have unfortunately buckled under. And we can look at all of that. I mean, the presentation before us, Chairperson, indicates that
certain, I've marked all of them, and I thought, let me not go into too much detail, but you see, the key regulatory requirements are there. It's under the finance presentation on how it must be capped so that the CETA is doing what it is supposed to do and not building bureaucracies. But if we look at the performance, and it goes back to the other slides, artisans and internships, the last block, learners completing work experience in internship programs, the achievement was about 50%, 48% to be exact. What is the reason for that? What is the reason for bursaries, those who are entering bursary programs and the number of learners completing bursary programs? Could we have an indication? 142%, they overperform as far as intake is, but as far as completion is, it is only 76%. So the concern is just, are we not at risk that we are building another bureaucracy and that we're losing the focus of the main purpose of the CETA's existence? The learning programs, Honorable Kunu has referred to that, we achieved only 65% of the KPIs. So we can go on like this, we can look through the annual report. Chairperson, my general concern is now that the administration and the governance has been stabilized, will the GAP CETA be able to focus on its prime key role? And that is churning out skills development for people to enter the market and be placed in work opportunities. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, members. Just the last from my side. Sorry, how can I do that? The Honourable Sewela and Honourable Tikana, my apologies.
Thank you, Chairperson. And well, let me also join the rest in congratulating the CETA for the clean audit. Many times when the word CETA is said, people think of all the wrong things that are happening in CETAs, but here today we have got a CETA that seems to have 10 things around. And it does show that there is good governance in place. But then from here, I want to know, what is the administrator doing to ensure that this good performance will continue long after he will have left CETA? Because many times you find that institutions are put under administrations, they get back on track, and when the administrator leaves, they revert back to their old ways of doing things. But again, Honorable Bozolo did ask this question, but I want to restate it. Whether since taking over the CETA, whether the administrator has identified any other form of irregularity that we should know of, and if so, what have you done about it? The distributions of learnerships and bursaries from the 2016-17 is quite interesting. Let me just use Northern Cape as an example. In 2015-16, the total allocation was 20, and in the next financial year it will be 500, and for that is probably a huge increase. And earlier on we got the reason why there was low intake in the previous slide was that because people were migrating, perhaps the shortage of firms and so on that people could go to. What has changed now? Will these people that you are targeting to assist do find places? Thank you.
Chair, where they are talking about discretional allocation, can they just explain that to me? I mean, why discretional? Why is it not based on some criteria or some material condition or proportion to population. I mean, my own way of thinking is that if it is discretional, doesn't it open us up for subjectivity? Can somebody be objective there? I mean, we all have our biases. And if it is discretional allocation, I'm just worried that I will, if it was me, you know, it will be subject to human error, human weakness, that we all favor other things, other people, and will allocate to those, and the allocation will not be just. So why discretional? Was there no any other way that they could use as a criteria to make sure that there's fairness, there's an unbiased and impartial, to control this thing in human beings of being partial?
Okay, just explain the Lotto. I don't understand. The Lotto is an organization on its own. Why do you have to assist them also? And maybe explain what it is that you are assisting them with. Secondly, the department, if the department can assist us with the following. One, what support are you giving to the CETA? You've placed them under administration. You've extended that that term again. If you can give the reasons why and what it is that you are doing to also bring the CETA up to scratch, both in relation to its governance, its finance, its core function, and so on. And then if the CETA can answer it also, but if you can also, if the department can also assist us with, some of the members have asked this question about the levy. Now, when we did oversight, we picked up the same problem on the levy. And some of the CETAs are saying that when it comes to government departments, they cited the Western Cape example of total refusal, and then they spoke about the other government departments. Some are complying, others not. To the department, would you want to change the legislation here from a dispensation of directives to a dispensation of, for lack of a better word, compelling? And then what I'm worried about is, there's nothing that in law that forces all of them to do what they are doing. They have been kind, and some of them have decided to be kind. But others have decided not to be kind, but to want the services. Now, is that true? That there's a list of non-paying. So are they expecting you to provide them with something whilst they are not paying? But remember, my difficulty is that if the department can explain the legal ramifications of this, and you think it's wise to carry on like this, and whether you are suggesting any legislative changes, because I think there's sufficient reason to say that there's quite a bit that we can get right with regards to skills development. If we change the current dispensation. So you are now between lunchtime and having to answer all those questions. So we're going to judge the skills of the CETA in showing us how you yourself can provide skills to the committee by answering all these questions in 10 minutes.
Thanks very much, Chairperson, and thanks to the members for the questions. I think firstly, let me also thank the committee for the support that they have provided, the engagement, the guidance, and insights in the previous engagement, which have led us to realize the improvements that we were deliberating on today. Now, let me first attempt to respond to the issue of the underspending versus overexpenditure. Overexpenditure, as reported by CFO, you would witness it in Program 1, which is administration. In that administration, as the Honorable Member Mkun was indicating, you then have your, that's where you have your support functions, your HR, your finance, your IT, and so on. Now, there's been two things. One thing is that there's been a trend over a long period of time, especially for the small sitters. I'm certain that cat sitter is not the only sitter that would have a challenge around admin budget, primarily for the reason that because of the size of the overall budget of a sitter in relation to the obligations that that sitter has to fulfill, including being an effective and efficient organization in the manner it does business. But if, for instance, you were to take efficiencies that we needed to bring under administration in the organization in terms of your systems that you needed to put in place, the level of skill that you needed to recruit during this period in terms of your management, you've got a CFO here who's a former senior manager of the Auditor General who was in the private sector space, who through, again, HR processes of recruitment, including your headhunting, needed to be approached to come and actually add the capacity within the sitter. And I'm saying some of those improvements that we're talking about today are as a result of some of the steps that you needed to take. Not because Chairperson was advocating for over-expenditure, but just to indicate that some of the sitters, especially the small ones, have got that predicament in terms of the budget. Now, let's come to the issue of underspending. My starting point is that overall, the fact of the matter is the sitter has improved in terms of its performance. Overall, yes, there are areas where you would still have challenges. From 34% to 84%, that's a significant improvement from a performance point of view. Now, take internships, for instance. Ourselves, within CAPSITA, with a small program that we had started of recruiting the 24 interns that we had recruited, in a space of 4 months of them being in the organization, 5 of them had to leave for better opportunities. Is it a bad thing? My view is that it's not. And how does that impact on what, because we report on that, then that inevitably will impact on the performance of CAT SITA in terms of its internship program, because not the 24 of them would have gone through the program up until they finished the program within CAT SITA. We are then likely to report 59% as an example. It doesn't mean that the program itself has been a failure, but from a performance point of view, because you would have had a particular number which will constitute your 100%, you would have had a dropout rate, which is not people going back to be unemployed, but people ceasing better opportunities elsewhere. The second example will be bursaries, for instance, for the employed. You would have employers that are within our sector applying for bursaries for their own employees, whether they managers or middle managers or lower level staff. The fact of the matter is, from our experience, because of the mobility within the sectors, someone gets a better opportunity elsewhere, leaves. That impacts on the targets, again. So I'm saying there is a variety of factors, and I'm not saying some of them are not things that could be arrested. Some of the learners, for instance, if you take, including some of your skills programs, where you want, if you take your EPWP, for instance, you take a program, someone comes into the program, discover that this is not what I thought it was, and therefore, the learner just decides to drop out. So you will also have factors that are beyond your control that in one way or the other will impact on that. Yes, all critical positions have been filled. And yes, there are still vacant positions, hence the 87% occupation rate in terms of the filling of positions. But the critical positions have been filled. The organization is going to be able to fulfill its obligations with the staff complement that is in the establishment. We've conducted, this question came last time we were here, Chairperson, and if I recall very well, we were still conducting investigations. Investigations have been conducted intensively within the CETA in terms of the allegations that were made and some of them that were in the public domain, which I think is something that concerns the members. And there's been no evidence suggesting that money has moved from CETA to somebody's bank account or to somebody's pocket. But there is evidence to suggest that processes have not been followed, in line with exactly what the CFO was raising. The 79 million irregular expenditure that we declared was as a result in the main of a number of transactions that took place without following process. Now, those can't necessarily lead to someone being arrested or charged criminally, but we charged a number of officials. Honorable members will remember, we've mentioned positions there of CEO, or CFO, and people resigned. But we didn't have any recourse of criminally charging anyone. The only, hence the one, where we had evidence of money moving from CETA's coffers to this particular former employee's account number, who was arrested, whose case is still ongoing until it is finalized. Now, so with regards to that, there is nothing that we are not putting before the committee that we're supposed to probably put before the committee in terms of what would have been the level of corruption or fraud. Where there were cases for people to answer, we have made people to account for their actions, and necessary steps were taken. There were employees that were dismissed. There were employees that resigned after being charged, and so on. Now, I thought that the issue of the regions, I had explained it to say when I was presenting, we needed to start somewhere. And in starting somewhere, we needed to pay a particular specific attention to where most of our stakeholders are located. And in establishing offices, we needed to take into consideration that as a factor, including ensuring that those provinces, which are rural provinces like your Northern Cape, your Limpopo, your Northwest, Eastern Cape, and so on, we do something to make sure that they are also part of the mainstream in terms of the decentralization approach, with an intention of ultimately ensuring that in each and every province, we've got regional offices. For instance, if we were to roll out offices in each and every provinces, I can assure you that the over expenditure that we'll be reporting in the here and now, but also in the next coming financial year, will probably be further more than the picture that we are seeing, because, again, of the limitations in terms of your size of your admin budget, because those offices, again, in terms of the staffing, will fall under that area. In terms of the measures that the administrator would have put in place to ensure that the CETA doesn't go back, we have recruited management. Management is in place. That's point number one. I can certainly, without any fear of doubt, say here that the management that is here in this organization in the here and now is capable enough of taking the organization forward. But what I think is going to determine how this organization functions moving forward is the kind of the accounting authority that will come into place. And really the intention from our side, working together with the skills branch within the department, is to make sure that once the accounting authority is appointed, proper processes of induction, outlining the roles and responsibilities, because those are some of the problems that we had encountered, where the accounting authority would move away from the role of accounting authority and interfere with management responsibility. So the intention really is to make sure that we close those gaps through the induction and intensive induction process. But I think what happens beyond that might not necessarily be under our control. But I'm certain that Mr. Lumka also will add, as it relates to some of the considerations that are being made by the department in terms of just trying to ensure that we strengthen that area of responsibility. The lottery, why are we assisting them? If the National Lottery Board as an organization has got employees to a point that they needed to contribute in terms of their numbers to the levies, they will, like any other stakeholder, apply through the windows and then they get allocation. Mostly, for instance, I remember the previous ones, they would apply for internships within their space. So they have got a right as part of any other employer that has got the capacity to provide work-based experience to do the uptake. But I think Ms. Pepane as well as CFO will cover some of the questions that were raised by the members. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Chair. I will address the question of the criteria for learners for various learning programs. We have adopted the NSDS 3 transformative and developmental imperatives, which among others prioritizes issues of gender, issues of class, geographic, and most importantly, we address our scarce and critical skills within the sector. In deriving to our scarce and critical skills, there is an intensive engagement with the stakeholders through the various mandatory grant processes to identify those skills. So those are the skills that we do fund. And also with our engagement with AG, the CETA needs to put emphasis on closing those gaps that are scarce and critical skills. So anything that falls outside the threshold is not really a very core focus. Though it's important, it's not a core focus because it will not be addressing those critical areas within the sector. Overall, Chair, if you look into with regards to performance program form, the 65%, if you look into my presentation, areas where we did not achieve are mainly completions. And this is where we are saying that there's a huge number of dropouts in certain instances. With regards to the skills programs, I did indicate to say the number of learners that were coming in were from previous financial years. Now, in certain programs, they took longer. So you will also see a picture in 16-17, the likelihood that we may overachieve because of programs that are currently underway. For example, if you have a target of learnerships in Program 4, invariably, they will only complete in the next financial year because it's a 12-month program. The same would apply with the internship program where learners are still within the system. They are likely to complete in the coming financial year. Chair, we do really run intensive stakeholder engagement, as I've alluded to earlier. And to answer the question on Sanbi, you may find that some of what the sector overall is saying is scarce and critical skills, therefore put them in a position where what they are offering may be important, but they're not scarce and critical skills. Once we have covered the gaps, only then will we look into those areas. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you, Chair. I'll just touch, I think, on about five areas. On overspending, the CETA has embarked on the revenue generation project, which ideally will make the CETA, because we're looking at the shortfall of about 28.4 million that we should be receiving per annum from the departments and other entities that we listed in the response to the PC committees. And the engagement with particular departments have started, and some are forthcoming. Some will need certain interventions at higher level. And I'll just touch base shortly on the issue of recouping international bursaries. It was the bursaries that were granted and the student went to study internationally overseas. Pre-administration, I think it has been addressed by the administrator.
in terms of the legal opinion was obtained, whether those can be recovered from students. From student side, the students followed the process. It was only the internal issues. The other one that is currently, that was still yet to be paid, is in court, whereby the sitter is opposing, wanting to set aside the whole contract, but then we're still obliged to pay because the matter is still going to be decided upon the court by the court. And then in terms of the regional offices, staff, support staff, on average we're having about six. And then salaries, I don't have the figures handy, but we are the one of the lowest paying cities. And then the issue of the Western Cape 30% contribution, I would just to indicate that we updated on Monday the responses to the committee questions, whereby we submitted that the Eastern Cape Sports, Recreation, Arts and Culture do contribute, including SANBI as well. And then on the issue of the definition of discretionary grant, is the definition per Skills Development Act and grant regulations is not necessarily mean it's indicative of a criteria that somebody looks at your face and decide, but it's a definition that is legislated as can be attributed to many financial statements of the cities. I think the last part, maybe what should be done to have all departments contributing the levies. We believe at this point in time, as much as the engagements are continuing, maybe at this level, the committee can assist also to direct Treasury, maybe to issue a circular. Certain departments and entities, they take something serious when it comes from National Treasury, not anywhere else. Maybe it's one of the considerations that need to be made, either Treasury to deduct the money direct and give it to the relevant sitter, or issue a circular that if you don't comply, then it's a matter of non-compliance in your financial statement that you will report on, and the AG can then follow that process as part of the audit process. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, just to add a few things. Afternoon, honorable members. Just to say that as CASSETA, we have got a firm foundation, and we believe that henceforth we'll be able to actually move forward with speed. One of the key performance areas for the regions is to actually engage with the various departments to be able to deal with the issue of the non-paying of the levies. That is number one. On the area of the increase of the targets, we are certain that with the skills or with the skilled people that we have in place in the regions, they would be able to engage with the employers in the areas and also to unearth the service providers. Because also dealing with the issue as to why was performance centered around Gauteng, it was the fact that most of our service providers were centered around Gauteng and specifically the Western Cape and to a lesser extent KZN. And we believe that with the staff that we have in place and the office that we have in place would be able to get more service providers and therefore would be better able to implement the programs. At the end of the day, we are a work in progress and we believe that we'll get there.
No, thank you, Chairperson. The question of the contribution by government departments towards sitters and the issue of 30%, I can suggest, Chair, to give you a written report, but I can indicate because it's long. I may take even longer. But in summary, yes, it's a fact that there was a challenge by the Western Cape. But when this 30% was challenged by the Western Cape, there were further complications from National Treasury, because the National Treasury also had a problem with this 30%. And this 30% emanated from DPSA. That's why I'm saying it would be good if then that one can put it in a report so that you can understand the proper context. But coming to your question of what is the department thinking about government departments contributing towards skills levy, are we thinking of amending the legislation? Because in Skills Development Levies Act, government departments are exempted from pay. And in Skills Development Act, then a government department, it is required that there's no compulsion. And in terms of our consultation process, even through this city landscape, there is an inclination that because government departments are not spending this money necessarily on skills training, and instead some, they wait until March, and then they dump to sitters like HTTP sitter. So we are thinking, but there are two legislation. The Skills Development Levies Act is a money act which resides in the National Treasury, because you can't change without negotiating with National Treasury. but we are thinking of amending Skills Development Act, as Advocate Boshoff indicated. But it is a thinking, but it has to be incorporated in some of the proposals that we are going to make, and because Labour and other social partners are harsh on us to say that force the government departments to pay. But it is going to be the process of the legislative review, which will require us to meet our colleagues in Church Square in Pretoria. Then the last one, the issue of, National Treasury. Not today. No, National Treasury is in Church Square, so I'm sorry, we often refer to them. No. Then the issue of supporting the CETA. You know, the administrator, when he took over, then we required him to provide us with the plan based on his diagnostic analysis of what is happening. Then, based on the work plan, on monthly basis, he has to provide the DG with the report and we analyze. So it's on the basis of the milestone that he has achieved that the contract or the administration has been extended. But this time around, it has been extended until April. And in the process, and it's for the reason that the board is not in place. And if we take away the administrator, then you can't leave the vacuum. So in all, not in all probability, but the plan is that by the end of the year, of this year, the process of appointing the board should be in place. And by beginning of next year, we think of doing the induction for the new board. But by April next year, our plan is that the new board has to take place. But in terms of the support of the administration, we're doing that one-on-one and every month. So you can rest assured. But whether then the CETA post-administration is not going to slip back to where it was, we have got all the regulations. You know, Minister, at the beginning of this year, published the governance charter and governance standards for the CETA. You can provide all the regulatory framework, but then it is incumbent upon the individuals to slide back. We can't guarantee, but the regulatory framework, we think that is clear and is tight for all the sitters. But whether then with the board when it comes, because it's the juristic person, we can't be there every day and ask them, what are you doing? Who are you awarding the bursary? But we normally pick it up after after the audit. But we are confident with the appointment of the executive in the case sitter that at least from the management perspective, things are going to be fine. Because the previous CFO, we're told that he had only metric. And I'm not sure about this one, but I think this one is qualified. So those are the things that makes us comfortable that at least from management side, we're not going to go back to the appointment of people without qualification in the CETA, because we object at the ones that have been appointed. Thanks, Chair.
Let's leave it there, honourable members. I think that I need to go to the chair's meeting now. So I wouldn't want us to. I want us to get to adoption of the program or otherwise of the committee. I want to ask that. I think there's a range of things that the members have asked, and not necessarily all of them have been answered. And so I would want to ask that those areas that the members have asked, I'm pretty convinced that not all the answers have convinced us. And so we should rather direct all the things that we have put to yourself, direct that to the ministers to say that we have had you before us, but these are the areas of concern. So as you are overseeing them as a department, we still would want to know. We hear what you're saying about the court, but we are convinced there's not one person in the that is going to land up in the court. That you have to satisfy us that in the area of corruption, these are the ones that you have been able to pick up. These are the steps that you are taking, and these are the moving forward. Because remember, you're doing what you are doing for the future board also. And you are doing because the department had a reason why they placed you under administration. So I think that those issues will remain with us. Not all of them have changed our mind. And we think that moving forward, those should be the issues that the members have pointed out that needs to be given special attention
your core areas and all of those. I'm not going to repeat it. You heard all of that. I want to ask that we end the CETA there. It's not a question.
No, Chair, when they give a report back, they must just please explain the apparent calculation errors on page 39, which Honourable Mkunu has raised.
Yes.
They must please explain, otherwise they must submit an amendment to the annual report to us. And, you know, errata report.
Yes.
Because I've also recalculated and I agree with Honourable Mkunu.
All of that I have meant that needs to be sorted out. May we thank you very much. I join the members that have congratulated you, but may we thank you very much and ask that you stay on the path of righteousness and don't look back and take us to the next step. Honourable members, the last point on the agenda, may I hear your views on the program from the 2nd, no, not the 2nd, from the 9th now, the 9th of November. And till the 7th, this is what Parliament said, we're going to stay here. Honourable Bozoli and Killian on the program.
Just two quick points. One is we usually see more CETAs than just one, and there are 21, and I'm just wondering when we're going to be considering their annual reports. And then the other one is Treasury has just released 7 substantial documents on higher education. Some of them are over 100 pages long with very detailed research, and we need to consider those because they are extremely insightful and useful reports. May I ask that the Treasury be invited to present them to this committee? Treasury there's 7 of them. One on CVETs, one on universities, one on NISFAS, one on overall funding. There's a whole on higher education in general.
Chairperson, I would like to support that suggestion that we receive that and that we receive a presentation, and maybe we could combine it with a presentation on the 9th of November, because we have a briefing by the Ministerial Task Team on developing a support and funding model. So perhaps that would both deal with the issue of finances and financing of the post-school education sector. But, Chairperson, my firm proposal would be, you see, the committee considered the first quarter report on the 31st of August, and usually we consider the second and third quarter reports together, but it's always beginning of the year and it's crushed and it's right on almost the end of the fourth quarter. So could we not perhaps suggest that the department on the 23rd of November, in addition to the presentation on the adjusted budget, if they could also include a reporting on the second quarter to us, so that we understand where they are in terms of achieving their targets. It must be the second quarter, because it's you know, they have obviously now concluded that. By the, you know, the third quarter will only be completed at the end of the year. But it's the second quarter, if we can have a presentation on that, to also run along with the presentation on the adjusted budget on the 23rd of November, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honourable Members. I don't see objections. We take the proposals and we're going to look at the possibilities of how we maneuver all of this. It is always subject to change because Parliament's programs change, and then we must just see how we can do it. But Honourable Members, on that note, thank you very much. I think the meeting is adjourned.
Oh,
thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.